Morning, everyone. I want to open up an organizational meeting to adopt the rules and review our work plan to introduce members. Okay. So we're missing Representative Tomei. She should be here shortly. Representative Lim is gone on special assignment. Whatever that, we'll figure that out later. But anyways, Ella should be brought to your attention to all those in the audience as well as my older colleagues here. That this is my rookie assignment, my maiden voyage today here, sitting in this position. So, okay, has everyone had an opportunity to review the rules, or would you prefer that Rick go over those?
Mr. Chair, these are the standard rules that committees and task forces use, I believe, are they not?
They are.
Yeah, and I'm happy to proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move we adopt these rules dated January 25th, 2006.
Okay. Representative Girard moves we adopt these rules dated January 25th, 2006. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of adopting these rules say aye.
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 And those opposed say no. Okay. No. All right. Motion carries. Okay, other items to consider going over before starting our informational hearing here today. A review of the work plan. Rick, would you like to just go over some of that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. In your packet of materials are a variety of items, one being the work plan for the task force. Right now there are, although we've not had final approved from the Speaker's office on the actual number of meetings. We anticipate, the task force says, anticipate at least four, perhaps five meetings, but at least four, and in it you'll see the draft work plan there. The second meeting being around the month of April, third meeting being in early June, fourth meeting being in September sometime. I will poll each one of your offices to see about your availability during those months, but if you know you have a conflict, then you can let me know. I appreciate it. Instead of going into detail, I will just defer to any questions you might have or recommend you contact Representative Olson if you have specific issues with any of the items on the work plan. There are some other paperwork here, Chair, would you like me to just touch on some of these things?
Yeah, go ahead and proceed then.
Thank you. There's also a memo from the Oregon CS Advisory Council. They've asked that, and it's that's how it's headlined. This is a memo with some information asking that this be entered into the record. This is probably more germane to the last item on our agenda, which is Oregon State Hospital. And just in summary, it's a request that the committee take in consideration that the state hospital undertake training and other efforts to ensure that, you know, violence that occurs so frequently in psychiatric hospital settings be addressed through like positive redirection and sensitivity training. So this item will be introduced into the record per the chair's approval. Other than that, I do not have any other housekeeping items. You do have a copy of the agenda in your packet, the contact information for the committee, and then just a grid on Senate Bill 572 that is kind of the genesis for this task force, and this will be the first item up on the agenda. With that, Chair, I have no other housekeeping items on my end.
Okay. I know you've not had an opportunity to review the memorandum from the Oregon CS Advisory Council. Do you have any concerns or issues with it being introduced? Okay, hearing none, then it's done. Okay, I guess we'll just continue on for the remainder of the task force. Representative Girard, just, you know, let everybody know that you're here, that you're part of it. And Representative Barnhart, neighbor down there in your house district, we appreciate both of you, and the other two when they show up someday. Okay. Let's see. I think that's I think we're at that point then. So what I'm going to do. Just to give you a heads up, members, or what I'm interested in doing here with this is that is to review Senate Bill 572. There's last session when this was brought to my attention at the early stages, lobbyist Martin Taylor approached me with a draft, and it's not to make copies of it, but this was it right here, and I reviewed it, and he was requesting that Senator Rick Metzger and myself sponsor this bill. And in the process of doing that, I did have a chance to go through the entire thing, but you can kind of see where there was a lot of different issues. I mean, red marks you can had some concerns with, and we moved on. And through the evolvement of it, we came to eventually Senate Bill, Senate Bill 572, the being gross version. There was a lot of work through that process, and then it was passed on the Senate side and came over to the House side, where we had a couple work groups trying to work and make it a little bit more sound where we wanted to go with it. And then the session ended, and we never did hear it any on the House side. So where I would like to go with it this time is develop it, explore more with it during this work group time period, and just solidify it to a point where we gather more evidence. Is this the direction we want to go? Is there another direction that we want to go? But to be open to that, and it being more kind of an investigation of gathering facts and move it. Okay. So what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to gavel the organizational hearing, and I'm going to open an informational hearing. And Holly, if you would come up and just give us just a little nutshell version of the whole process of what Senate Bill 572 is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. The 2005 Legislative Assembly considered legislation establishing protections for nursing staff members who experience workplace violence. The general intent of the bill was threefold, which doesn't get to all of the issues, but will give you kind of an overview of where I think this legislation went, or the 19 sets of drafts and amendments that I drafted covered. The first general element of the bill was to require nursing staff members to report to law enforcement agencies assaults by patients on nursing staff members in order to develop data on the nature and the extent of the problem. The second general purpose was to require employers to develop and implement written violence prevention programs. And third, to provide authorization for nursing staff members to refuse to treat patients under certain circumstances and to establish non-retaliation provisions. As this bill evolved, there were, I summarized the issues in two general areas. One is the who was going to be involved, who was going to be included or excluded, of which there was a lot of discussion, and then what they were going to be doing. I was going to do when, why, and how, and I didn't get that far. First of all, the who, in terms of who covers the bill, generally speaking, it was registered nurses and other nursing personnel providing direct patient care. That definition or that group of individuals stayed consistent throughout the legislative session. One of the areas in which there was a lot of discussion was who, for the purposes of this legislation, would be a nursing staff employer. That was the definition that was developed that would identify those entities, those employers, who would be responsible for implementing the bill. This list changed as often as the weather, and let me list for you the various entities that at some point or another were on the list or off the list. only to give you a sense of where the discussions were going, not to make any value judgments about them, but to just kind of set the stage for you. The first one would be hospitals, and including the Oregon State Hospital. Generally speaking, one of the things that came up last session in a context of a variety of bills is that when we use the definition of hospital, without specifically listing the Oregon State Hospital, because it is a licensed facility, it ends up sweeping in or including the Oregon State Hospital. Some of the versions that we did included or excluded that facility. But generally speaking, when you talk about hospitals, I think one of the things that I learned during last session, which was in fact new to me, was that to assume or exclude that the Oregon State Hospital and its campuses are included or excluded is a conversation that has to occur, because the definition of hospital does include them. The second entity that was on and off the list was ambulatory surgical centers, and then the remainings were home health agencies that are licensed by the state of Oregon, home health agencies that are associated with a hospital or contract only with a county health department, with the intent of trying to narrow that sum, county health departments who provide home health services, public entities that provide public nursing services, or that contract to provide public health services. So as you can see, there was rather a large array of entities who, in fact, provide either inpatient or home health services, and which of all of those entities that employ those individuals, how narrow or broad do you want the scope, did the legislature want the scope of this to be? And I think the list is, by the time the session ended, it was probably as, I think we had touched on any entity that possibly would be employing nurses who would be providing either inpatient care or home health services care, which is the second group that was considered in this. There was some discussion briefly during the course of the session about which law enforcement agencies would be, to whom these reports would be made, and eventually that was city, county, and the Oregon State Police. The next set of questions had to do with what was going to be reported, whether or not that it was clearly going to be assaults, but whether or not there's going to be attempts to cause or intentionally knowing or recklessly causing physical injury was where it arose. But the question really becomes, what is it that a nurse, what act is it that you want or that the legislation considers is going to be reportable? Then the question of what is reportable and who does it get reports was the next set of issues. First of all, does it get reported to a law enforcement agency? Does it get reported to an employer? The circumstances under which a report is made, whether or not the report is going to go into the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting System, and whether or not that would be required. That is the entity, just to provide some background information on that piece. The Oregon State Police Records and Statistics Department, that's not quite right, but that's close enough, does an annual report of crime statistics in Oregon, and by having this information entered into the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Program, it would allow at some point the data to be collected and then included in some subsequent report. And that was the issue around the inclusion of it going into that database. Other things that occurred in this aspect was that at all times, could the reporter have immunity and the report would be confidential? And then finally, there were included in this non-retaliation provisions or unlawful employment practice, violations for retaliatory action. Clearly, there was an intent or desire to prohibit nursing staff employers from retaliating if reports were made in good faith. Other aspects of this that kind of did stay consistent. Nursing staff employers, whatever that group ends up being, had a requirement to produce an annual report regarding their assaults. And then there was specification in the various versions about what would be in the report. There was also discussion or inclusion at all points of a written violence prevention and self-defense program. And then finally, at some point along the way, inclusion about self-defense provisions were added, so that if an assault occurred and there was self-defense alleged by the nurse who was responding, that those elements would be taken into account. I would, there are probably other minor things, but I think in terms of the biggest picture, that I think covers it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
But I can.
Mr. Gerard.
I will try, Holly.
Okay.
Could you go into, I noticed there was quite a discussion in regards to language. There are, for myself, I'm having difficulty seeing what type of language would be considered an assault.
Verbal language?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I'm not aware. Can you point me to what you're looking at?
Let's see here. I know I saw it somewhere.
It may inject, Chair, he is also looking at this table that I've done. Do you have a copy of this in case?
I do. In that case, let me just step back. Because the definition of assault that stayed fairly consistent through the bill addressed attempting to cause or intentionally knowing or recklessly causing physical injury, I don't believe that, well, I'll call it verbal abuse, because it sounds like that's what you're getting at, was covered, that verbal abuse by a patient would have been, would have fit the definition of assault for the purposes of this bill. One of the things, if I might just add, one of the things that was more difficult about this is that so much of the, in the development of this, it was really dependent on the key definitions of the bill. And one of them was clearly assault, where there had to be an attempt or a causing of bodily injury. A true actual assault, in kind of the criminal code sense, was actually where the definition came from. The second was who the employers were that are going to be responsible for overseeing and implementing this. That was one of those lists that changed all the time. And then who would have to, the nursing staff members, and then as I said, that list really never did change. But I think at all times, verbal abuse, what I'll call verbal abuse by patients against the nursing staff member was not included in the bill.
Thank you. Yeah. Follow up on that, if I may, and then I have another question. Thank you. I practiced criminal law long enough ago so that I can only ask questions based on vague recollections. Okay. One form of language that you haven't really covered yet are threats. A harassment, foul language, or something of that sort is a different issue than a direct threat. Would a direct threat, even though it's simply a verbal form, would that constitute an assault under this definition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we can have a contest because it was a very long time ago that I, too, practiced criminal law. The most direct answer to your question is no.
Okay.
Is that a harassment? I mean, if there was just verbal...
A threat is something like, I'm going to do X to you because of Y.
There was in an earlier version of the, in one of the many iterations of this, I think there was some language that talked about placing another person in fear of imminent bodily injury. That language came out early on. And so
that was removed early on?
That was removed early on. I think in the original version of the bill, there was assault meaning intentionally knowing or recklessly placing another in fear of imminent bodily injury.
Okay.
That came out immediately.
Yeah, and of course, that is the language that I'm reading in this chart, and that's why I raised the question.
Right, and that came out relatively early on in session. So but yes, in that case, your answer had that definition. Again, this whole thing is so definitionally driven. If the original definition of assault had not been changed, then some type of harassment or some type of verbal language that would place another in fear of imminent and bodily harm would have been sufficient. But that came out, my recollection was relatively early.
Yeah, the intent, just to give you a heads up on what we were wanting to try to do, and Holly, you can chime in here on this, was actually to the whole definition of assault as we progressed through this bill was to have it reflect exactly what the criminal code was. So it you didn't have any, you know, problems, misunderstandings.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A question of the chair. Should we, we've got three different versions of this bill, and I'm already seeing some confusion as to which one we're talking about. Does the chair wish us to use the B engrossed, the A engrossed, or go back to the original bill when we're talking about?
Actually, it would be the B engrossed because that's where we left off, and that's a good question. That's where, to me, we have progressed and evolved to a point where I was pretty comfortable with where the bill was at that time. But again, like I mentioned earlier, we're at a point right now where we need to do some additional exploration and investigation.
Okay. One comment on that, and then a separate topic, if I may. My recollection is that in the criminal law, the term assault, it means what the rest of us think of as battery. In the old civil law definition of battery is when you actually hurt somebody or cause some damage. And I think that's what the criminal law definition of assault is. If I remember the 1971 criminal code when those things were all redone, that was when I was first practicing law. Now, the question I have is on a different topic, if I'd like to switch topics. And that is back on this reporting issue. You mentioned I'm lost in the language here, but you mentioned a reporting system that's used by the police. And the question I had was, if assaults under this bill went into that reporting system, would that affect the general criminal incident statistics that are produced out of that system?
Mr. Chair, and
of course, the policy question is, do we want to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, as I understand the intent, and based on my conversations with the folks at the state police who do this, and again, this is going back a while, to the degree that all assaults across the board are an officer shows up, there's an assault, they take a report, he or she takes a report, it goes into the database. There is the ability currently to take out or separate certain of those assaults into subcategories.
Okay.
So, for example, in that current report, there is a subcategory for domestic violence. That's the obvious. That's the one that comes to mind the most. That over time, as public education and practice and policy have changed, more reports of domestic violence are reported as assaults.
Mm-hmm.
They go into the database as assaults, and then in the reporting, in this report that they produce in, I think, April of every year, when they have money, because one year it didn't come out, they can say, of this X number of assaults that we have, there is also within that universe domestic violence assaults that are such a percentage. And so, theoretically, I suppose, if an officer is called to a scene of an assault, the assault should go in. But I think, as we all know, particularly with the domestic violence analogies, practice and procedure have changed over time as people wanted more and different kinds of information. And I think the intent of this, and I shouldn't really speak for the requesters, but I think the intent was, if these assaults are occurring and they are acts that would otherwise be crimes or alleged to be crimes, I do think that the domestic violence analogy is a good one, because for a long time those weren't entered. There was not good databases. So I think it will change them, but only to a slight degree, because arguably if an officer is called, then that report should go in. It just gives them the ability to say, well, we have this many domestic violence, we have this many on children, because we actually have another category of kids in there, and this many occurred in this particular setting.
Thank you. That answers my question. Yeah.
Very good. Okay. Thank you, Holly, very much. I just want to make a point with especially Representative Gerard, you brought up the concept of the being gross, that I want to kind of share that with you, keep you in mind, because that's where we had come. But I'm open to want to continue doing the investigation to move further with that. Okay, so next, Michael Wood. Where am I?
Thank you.
something else that might be helpful is to have a copy, a complete copy of that, of Senate Bill 572. That was the bill.
Yeah. Okay.
Otherwise, we're kind of tempted to duplicate a lot of what we've got here.
We can do that for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mike, if you can introduce yourself then.
Okay. Chair Olson, members of the task force, thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. In September, I began my duties as the new administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division, known as Oregon OSHA, within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some background information to the task force, and as you continue your discussions, the Oregon OSHA staff and I will be available to help in whatever way we can. You have written testimony from me. I will keep my oral comments brief this morning and highlight a couple issues and perhaps return to some of the particular issues that you were raising in questions a moment ago. I do want to give you some basic context for, first of all, the way Oregon OSHA works in relation to employers, some discussion of workplace violence, looking at it from the standpoint of addressing it as a risk in the workplace, which is a little bit different from looking at it through the context of the criminal code. I want to spend a little bit of time, because I know it's been an issue in the past and continues to raise questions, talking about record keeping and what data is or is not readily available to us. The short answer to that is we actually have less data on the size of the problem than you might assume. Oregon OSHA, as you're probably aware, functions under both a state and a federal mandate. In addition to our State Authorizing Act and the Oregon Safe Employment Act, we are a designated and approved state plan of the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration. In both of those contexts, we have an enforcement and an education responsibility. We do roughly 5,000 enforcement visits annually. In those visits, we try to include educational components as well as enforcement of the occupational safety and health codes. We do 2,000 on-site consultations, employer-requested visits, every year. We also provide a variety of educational materials, workshops, training sessions, in an effort to provide information to employers. Some of that material focuses on workplace violence, and in fact, the last page of my testimony is a couple pages out of our resource catalog that has a variety of videos that are available from our resource library related to violence in the workplace. In addition to that, we have a workshop. It's an online workshop that walks people through what they would need to do in order to develop a workplace violence prevention plan. In applying standards, there are two broad categories of issues that we address. There are issues where we have very specific standards and guidelines for employers to follow. In the context of healthcare, an example of that would be our rules related to occupational exposure to bloodborne pathogens, where there's very specific guidance, there are very specific rules to follow. In addition to that, both the law and our rules include general obligations for employers to address hazards that arise in the workplace. Because we have no specific rules related to workplace violence, as well as a number of other issues, that's the context in which we would look at this issue, whether it represents a recognized hazard, whether the employer, in a sense, is taking reasonable steps to provide a safe and healthful workplace for his or her employees. Turning to the issue specifically of workplace violence, and if you look at page 3 of my written testimony, you'll find a discussion there of three categories of violence. Over the last 15 to 20 years, this has become sort of a standard within the occupational safety and health context in talking about violence, because there are different types and different sources of violence, and interestingly enough, what gets the most media attention sometimes is not the largest workplace issue. So if I can briefly go over those just in an effort to give us all sort of a common vocabulary, the various materials that you've been given and that you'll continue to see from various parties, to the best of my knowledge, I'll use this four categories. The first, what's called type 1 violence, is violence with criminal intent. And if you think of somebody robbing a taxi cab, robbing a convenience store, and in the process killing or injuring the person they're encountering. That's the violence that we're talking about here. It accounts for about 85% of workplace homicides nationally, but it's actually a small piece of the overall picture of violence in the workplace. These tend to be incidents where there is either a fatality or there is no injury, and so there's no resulting claim. Type 2 violence is violence arising out of a customer or client relationship. And typically in healthcare, as well as in the social services, that is what we tend to be talking about. That would include not only violence by a patient or by a resident, it also would include violence by that patient's patient or resident's relative or friend resulting from care issues. This type of violence nationally accounts for relatively few fatalities. The statistics tend to run around 3 to 5%, with numbers that relatively small. Obviously, there's variation year to year. But it is the vast majority of the incidents of workplace violence, and it's why social services, health services, and public service are those areas in the workplace where workplace violence is most frequently a source of injury. Type 3 violence is violence by a worker or coworker, and this is what the public and frequently what employers think they need to focus on. It is relatively infrequent. And, you know, even if you think of the typical vernacular of going postal because of some well-publicized events at the U.S. Postal Service, in fact, the U.S. Postal Service has no higher frequency of these sorts of events than the typical employer. There are control measures that can be taken on that, but that is not the primary problem. That's certainly not what drives the fact that there are higher incidents of this type of violence overall within healthcare. And then type 4 is what's generally considered violence that spills over from a personal relationship or domestic violence spillover. That can either be a spouse or significant other coming into the workplace, or there could be a personal relationship actually within the workplace that plays out there. Events of either of those types would show up in type 4. I offer the typology partly to tell you that when you're talking about violence prevention efforts in the context of healthcare, looking at the specific risks that arise out of that context, you're going to primarily be talking about type 2 violence. And that changes the nature of the controls that you might try to use if you were dealing with other violences. You would pursue different efforts. I want to make a couple other observations related to violence as a workplace hazard. The first is that when we assess it from the standpoint of a workplace hazard, we do not focus on the question of the intent of the perpetrator, at least in assessing whether or not the hazard is real. In nursing homes, when you're dealing with residents with dementia, developmentally disabled group homes, mental hospitals, a number of places where the incidence of injury by clients or by patients is high, the question of intent is a very real question. But from the standpoint of is there a risk in the workplace and does it need to be addressed, that's really not the issue. In fact, the question doesn't even come up in most workplace contexts because we don't worry about whether a table saw had the intent to remove someone's fingers. The risk is there and the risk is real. Where intent becomes significant is when you look at the control measures. If you're dealing with an aggressive person who has an intent to act, the way in which you deter that behavior is different from somebody who's lashing out in the throes of dementia and really has no intent, doesn't anticipate it, and the way in which you would control that behavior might require different techniques. The other thing I want to say is it is clearly possible to reduce the incidence of violence in the workplace. There are a number of tested techniques, not only in general, but a number of efforts specific to healthcare, and there are a number of guidance documents available from the state and federal government, from employer associations. It is certainly possible to reduce the risk. This is one of those areas where it's not possible to realistically reduce the risk to zero. We're talking about mitigating the risk. We're not talking about a situation where we can really eliminate it. Finally, and I'll elaborate a little bit on this, when we're talking about violence in the workplace as a hazard within the context of occupational safety and health, we're talking about the risk of physical injury. The notion of psychic violence and emotional trauma is not something that we would normally consider within the context of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. That said, when you assess the risk of violence in the workplace, when you assess really the risk of any workplace injury, you don't want to just look at the injuries that occurred. You want to look at the injuries that might have occurred or that nearly occurred. So in that sense, it would be, if I were trying to assess an employer's risk, I would be very interested in what level of threat they had. So that for me it would be very different between looking at oral abuse, you know, cussing folks out, the distinction you were making earlier, Representative Barnhart, and actual threats of violence that didn't manifest themselves. For an employer to effectively control violence, that employer is going to have to deal with those sorts of threats and figure out a way to assess the risk and address it in that context. It won't be enough to simply wait for the injuries to occur. That's particularly true of the most serious threats, where perhaps fatal violence is threatened. You don't want to wait and only track that based on the fatality or the near fatality. You want to look at what we would typically call near misses. Specifically with regard to health care, and you obviously will be receiving a good deal of information. Actually, I've seen the handouts and some of the material. I grabbed some material from my desk, but I did you the courtesy of not making copies of all of it for you to wade through. Actually, that has nothing to do with violence. I just brought it along to try to impress you. There's a good deal of literature in the field about violence in healthcare facilities specifically. And I just want to offer some general observations in that context. First of all, if you take the broad category of healthcare, about half the violent incidents, the injuries across the country, occur in healthcare. It is dramatically higher than in any other industry sector. And it has to do with the nature of the service, the nature of the populations, the nexus of a number of things.
Mr. Woods,
go ahead.
What type of violence? I'm trying to get a picture of what we're talking about.
Chair Olson, Representative Gard, in the context of the comment I just made, it would be a wide-ranging definition of a violence that would include, for example, a nursing home patient scratching or shoving a caregiver who was trying to assist the patient in rolling over. It would include incidents in developmentally disabled contexts, something I'm conscious of because of my own daughter, where someone lashes out really without intent. When we talk about incidents of injury related to violence, what we're really talking about is any situation where an injury occurs as a result of another individual striking, scratching, biting the person who's injured. So it's really anything where the source is another person. Now, when you look at specific applications in healthcare, the nature of the violence and the nature of the risk in different healthcare facilities varies. In nursing homes, residential facilities, it's one set of risks. In some of the patient floors in a hospital, it would be similar to those. You either have people not really aware of themselves or people dealing with frustration and lashing out at the system. The spouse of a patient who's frustrated with the care and shoves a caregiver. In emergency rooms, you get a little bit different picture of violence that comes close. I would say in some respects is the place where you're most likely to have the high risk of fatal violence because you've got an uncontrolled clientele. You're more likely to have weapons introduced. You're also more likely to have an immediate spillover related to drugs or other criminal activity. So the nursing home has a unique exposure. The place where the client exposure and the highest risks tends to come together tends to be in the treatment of the seriously mentally ill. And so mental health facilities can be dealing with folks who are at times very violent. The risk is much greater than it is dealing with a nursing home patient with dementia just because of the physical capabilities of the individuals involved. So I realize I didn't give you a very crisp answer, but I think what I'm saying is it really runs a wide breadth that, for various reasons, all coalesce in the context of healthcare. I want to touch just briefly on the data available, and I discussed this in a little bit more detail beginning at the bottom of page 5. Employers are required to keep records of injuries and illnesses that occur in their workplace. They are not, however, required to report those to Oregon OSHA. They do include them if they're surveyed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that's the source of the national and state data reported by BLS. With regard to workers' compensation claims, employers will report that to the insurance provider. The insurance provider reports to the Department of Consumer and Business Services only what is called the disabling claims. And in that context, we're talking about a claim where the employee was injured severely enough that they missed more than 3 days of work. So it tends to be a much smaller section of the overall claims than you would see if you had the full claim picture. There are a number of disabling claims within the context addressed here. The number for 2004, based on our cutting of the data, and it was a little bit of a moving target as the definitions in the bills were modified somewhat. But we identified 49 accepted disabling claims in the 2004 calendar year that would have been addressed by the bill. There is a requirement that employers notify Oregon OSHA directly in the event of a fatality or in event of a workplace injury that results in a hospital admission. But that doesn't really give us a rich data source to sort of look at what's happening overall. It allows us to go and investigate those specific cases, but it is a very limited sample. A hospital admission, really, we're talking about an overnight stay. There's a good deal of hospital treatment that happens now in the emergency room that wouldn't generate a hospital admission and wouldn't generate that required report. Based on the national studies, based on the data available here in Oregon, including a study that was done by the Department of Consumer and Business Services a number of years ago, I think it's safe to say that there is certainly a meaningful risk within Oregon healthcare facilities of violence. Being able to really get a clear picture of that risk and the extent to which different intervention techniques occur isn't something that we're able to do with the data we currently have available. I would welcome any further questions you might have.
Question I have then, I guess, for you, Mike, is you're not in a position, and your organization is not in a position to collect the data where the patient. But Rick is the nurse, and I come up and I pop him in a jaw, but he doesn't want to report it. You're not going to get that type of information. But if he's gone for 3 days as a result of filing a Safe 801 form and there was a serious injury to him like that, then you'd receive that information. Is that?
Charleston, that's exactly correct. We might find out about the incident if we happen to do an enforcement visit or a consultation for that matter. And in looking at the risk, somebody might report that to us, but it would be purely anecdotal. In terms of any sort of systemic analysis, it would be limited to the disabling claims.
Yes.
I'm going to come back to definitions. Go to corrections or a jail. The person who may or may not have to sort of check in a new client. Most counties have facilities where there is a mental health representative there and a physician available to check each coming inmate as to liability, what to assess the condition of the inmate at that point. Is that person considered under this bill, in your opinion?
Chair Olson, Representative Gerard, I'm not sure that I am clear enough on the definitions of the bill to be the best person to answer the question. That person, regardless of their intent and mental capability, would represent a workplace risk that should be addressed by the employer, and that I'm comfortable saying. I'm not clear exactly how the reporting mechanism in the bill would work with regard to acts that were clearly assaultive in nature, but where the question of intent might make it not a criminal act.
Okay.
I have one too, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been talking this morning about injuries due to violence. Where in the hierarchy of things does that fall in terms of risks in the workplace of injury as compared to other causes of injury? And I would think in the healthcare context, a possible cause of injury would be contracting a disease as a result of being in a place where there's a lot of people who are sick. In working in a furniture manufacturing facility, that saw we were talking about earlier would be a source of injury. Where does this fall in the hierarchy of risks?
Chair Olson, Representative Barnhart, I'm not sure what the answer would be across the board. I actually know what the answer is in the context of healthcare, and it may surprise you somewhat. Violence or assaultive type behavior, to leave the legal question of assault aside, is the second largest source of injury and illnesses typically in healthcare across the board. The largest source is patient handling. Violence is a distant second. The things that we naturally associate with those environments related to disease don't show up in the injury and illness reports as being as serious an issue of violence. One reason for that is that there are control measures in place that address those. Another possible reason is it's also likely that there's some significant underreporting there, as there also is for violence. But fairly consistently across the nation, the number two cause of injuries and illnesses in healthcare is violence or violent-type behavior.
Okay. Follow up. By patient handling, you mean things like heavy lifting? Or do you mean something else?
No, I'm referring to lifting, lifting, turning, moving, supporting issues around the patient's mobility or limited mobility.
So the assistant's bad back resulting from trying to move somebody heavy is the kind of thing you're talking about.
Chair Olson, Representative Barnett, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mike, could you address the issues of maybe bills that have been presented in other states that are similar to this one?
Chair Olson, I'm familiar with two states that have adopted laws that address workplace violence in healthcare specifically. They're California and Washington. California's law was enacted in 1993. It was focused on security plans and security implementation in acute care facilities and mental health facilities. I'm somewhat more familiar with, because of my own background, the Washington law, which was passed in 1999. In essence, it required record keeping by employers of violent incidents, and that was broader than just injuries and illnesses related to violence. It required that employers develop a written workplace violence prevention plan. It required those employers to train their employees in the context of that plan and to address those issues accordingly. In relation to record keeping, while it required record keeping, it was not what I would describe as a surveillance program. The record keeping enhanced the information that was available to the employer, but there is in Washington no comprehensive capture of those records, no sort of central repository or overall surveillance. It's available to the employer and employees in the worksite. The Washington law applies, and it defines its application looking at the authorizing statutes. It applies to hospitals. It applies to various home clinics, home care. It does not apply to nursing homes or residential care facilities. And the original bill did not apply to the state mental hospitals, although in 2000 a bill was passed that basically provided the same provisions for the state mental hospitals there.
Okay.
That's a good question.
Go ahead.
As a follow-up to that, thank you, Chair, do we know what the result or impact of those, for example, Washington State's bill has been, in both in terms of incident and you know, other issues, maybe workers' compensation and things like that?
Charleston, Mr. Bacobian, there is a NIOSH grant that has been awarded to evaluate the effect of both the California law and some related educational efforts that took place at the same time. To the extent I've been able to locate that grant, that research is ongoing and doesn't have any conclusions. In the context of Washington, there hasn't been a comprehensive assessment of the impact of the legislation. Washington did do a comprehensive analysis of injury and illness due to workplace violence through the year 2000, and the authors of that report noted that there was a downturn in violent incidents in healthcare specifically in 1999 and 2000, really too early for the bill to have taken effect. But they hypothesized that part of the impact there was probably the heightened awareness and discussion in the legislature and in the executive branch, which was causing attention to be brought to these issues even in advance of the legislation being passed. Other than that, they haven't reached a conclusion about the effectiveness of the bill.
Okay. You, Mike, you mentioned, actually just kind of triggered a question here for me. It kind of lays some background to it, too, as well. You used the word educational effort. So is that also part, or are you aware of that for the training part of it up there in Washington?
Chair Olson, yes. One of the there are two components to education. One is educating the employers and providing them with resources. The Washington legislation does provide encouragement, I guess, to the state's Department of Health and the Department of Labor and Industries, where the Occupational Safety and Health Program is located, and there were educational efforts around that. The legislation itself requires training in identifying potential violence and in mitigating the effects of that violence, de-escalation techniques, that sort of thing. It doesn't specify exactly what the training should be. It requires that the training be consistent with the employer's workplace violence prevention plan. And so the plan really defines the detail of the training that will be provided, but the law clearly recognizes that a written plan in the absence of training in the plan would have little impact.
Okay. I can share here from my experience having been with the state police and everything, one of the things that we had learned to recognize, you know, hostile situations and how to try to de-escalate them and try to mitigate it is what we call the term of verbal judo. And I'm just, are you familiar with that type of training, or has there been any effort like that for training up there?
Charleston, I'm not sure if it's exactly what you describe as verbal judo, but the most effective violence prevention techniques, and this is reflected in the various guidelines, in case studies, when it comes to an actual incipient incident, giving individuals training so that they understand how to respond to that in a way that reduces the tension and de-escalates the situation, is one of the most effective prevention measures that can be provided. It is not normal for us to respond to conflict in a way that is actually going to reduce the conflict, particularly if you're dealing with an agitated patient or an agitated spouse. Our tendency when faced with confrontation and with anger is to respond in kind and push back. The best violence prevention measures actually suggest that you allow that to, on some level, run its course. Rather than raising your voice, you lower your voice and you do some things to try to move the technique down. Those techniques, a number of employers and a number of case studies have suggested, can be very effective in not only reducing the overall incidence of violence, but certainly diffusing incidents when they occur by eliminating the risk of injury. There are other things that you need to do training on in terms of security procedures, when you need assistance, how to call security, code words, alarm systems that would all be based on the particulars of a facilities plan.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles, and members of the task force.
Okay, next, Dr. Christine Campbell and Brian DeWestman.
Good morning.
Okay. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, then
I certainly will.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Olson and members of the committee. My name is Chris Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Nursing, and thank you for this opportunity to share with you some information about healthcare worker safety. My goal this morning is to talk about healthcare worker safety and some violence prevention programs in particular as a part of an overall comprehensive safety policy. There are many parallels to patient safety as well, but I'm going to be really speaking about healthcare worker safety, and I will tell you just a little bit about the Oregon Center for Nursing as well, so you know where we come from. The Oregon Center... Yes.
Just a little housekeeping. These mics pick up real well at the witness table, so you can stand back a little bit from the
stand
mic.
Back like that?
Yeah, or you'll end up popping it, so
okay.
You don't have to get real close. Thank you.
I don't need to leave it. All right. The Oregon Center for Nursing is a nursing workforce center. It was created in 2002 to help deal with the nursing shortage in Oregon. It's a nonprofit organization. There are two employees, myself and an assistant. We're governed by a board of directors that is one each of the nursing organizations that created it, and I'm a member of the ONLC also. The organizations that created the Center for Nursing, as you can see, are varied. It's the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives, who are the nurse administrators, Oregon Council of Associate Degree Programs, those are the directors of the community college nursing programs, Oregon Council of Deans are representatives from the baccalaureate, they're the deans from the baccalaureate and higher programs of nursing in the state of Oregon. Oregon Nurses Association, as you know, is the professional organization and also the labor piece, and the Oregon State Board of Nursing, which is the regulatory. So we cover all aspects of nursing in Oregon and are working to solve the nursing shortage. Our mission is to advance evidence-based decisions about the nursing workforce and recruitment and retention of nurses in Oregon, because Oregon's health depends on it, we believe. And it is that way that with a nursing shortage that is present and is going to continue to grow, we really need to make sure that we do everything we can to retain our healthcare workers, which includes our nurses. So a little overview of healthcare. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and this is information from their website. Healthcare is the second fastest growing sector in the U.S. economy, so it is a lot of workers. Women represent nearly 80% of the healthcare workforce. Healthcare workers, and Mr. Woods already talked about this, the number of risks that they are exposed to, the hazards are including needle stick injuries, back injuries, as was spoken about, latex allergies, violence, and stress. And as Mr. Woods also pointed out, much of this is preventable, and yet the numbers continue to grow. So we're in a position now where it's a good time to focus on the safety of the healthcare workers, because there's a lot of people and there's a lot of opportunity to make it better. Healthcare worker safety, the violence prevention programs should really be a part of the overall comprehensive safety and health programs in any employment situation. And an environment that is safe for workers is also going to be safe for patients, which is really what we're about. It's time to do something because, as we've heard, the healthcare workers face higher risks than the average worker does. So we can do something about that. And as I said, in view of the nursing shortage and healthcare workers' shortage, it's just not a nursing shortage that we're facing. It's all healthcare workers. We need to take care of the workers that we do have. These numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is off an OSHA document, says that 48%, which Mr. Woods already referred to, occur from assaults and violent acts that occur in healthcare and social services settings. Most occur in hospitals, nursing and personal care services facilities, and residential care services. And the people most affected are nurses, nursing aides, orderlies, and attendants. The incident rates, and this refers to the injury piece that Representative Barthart talked about, is overall for healthcare workers is 9.3, and you can see for nursing and personal care workers it's 25, which is much higher. The average injury rate in any workplace environment is 2, so that's again making the point that it's an issue in a healthcare worker. And it is believed that it's very underreported. 1 in 5 or 80% are not reported. And that's part of what we can do something about. It's a universal issue, and it's everyone's responsibility. We all own a little bit of this. zero tolerance policies against violence in the workplace are required if we're going to have a safe environment. As Mr. Wood said, it's probably not realistic to get rid of it completely, but we certainly can do much to mitigate. We need comprehensive prevention programs and reporting mechanisms and disciplinary policies to deal with it when it occurs. For institutions, what I did is I looked at the major nursing organizations to see what their recommendations were regarding prevention of violence in the workplace. So I will give you information from three of the organizations and what they suggest, and we'll see that there's a theme through all of that, and it also fits what OSHA recommends. So we know what needs to be done. So for institutions, to provide a safe workplace and written policies, employee training, proper staffing, and it's important that they follow up any incidents. People won't report if they don't think anything is going to be done about it. Implement a comprehensive policy for preventing and managing workplace violence that establishes clear expectations of employee behavior and what needs to be done when something happens. Confidential reporting and freedom from reprisals are also important. Administrative support for all of the policies. It must be a management and worker shared responsibility. And develop and implement the violence prevention programs. And listening carefully, what part of the gathering data is gathering data from your own employees so we know what's happening in our own facilities. For nurses, there's a responsibility here too, and that's to develop a culture where it's not tolerated and where it's promptly addressed and reported and where coworkers are supported. Advocate for policies that will improve the health of the worker and the workplace. Participate in all the training. As Mr. Woods pointed out, training is a huge component of any violence prevention program, and we all need to participate in that training as well as the employers, and mentor people how to respond. As he said, the training components, if we practice those and we teach them to each other. The American Nurses Association recommendations for violence prevention programs are very similar. Creating a task force, analyzing the data, which means talking to our folks too, conducting a workplace walkthrough so they know what's those physical attributes as well as personal attributes for a physically safe environment, surveying employees, using the data to identify the risks in that facility, implementing the solutions, and then evaluating how things are going. The International Council of Nurses also has recommendations. This is an international issue. It is not just a U.S. issue or an Oregon issue. Again, identifying the risk behaviors and the environmental triggers, taking preventive measures to reduce or eliminate the risk, applying incident management mechanisms when violent acts does occur, guaranteeing access of all involved to effective support structures, including each other, keeping reliable records, evaluating the incidents, and then changing your policies based on how things are going and how well they're working, and then developing appropriate recommendations on the basis of those findings. As you can see, those fit very well with OSHA's overall safety and health program recommendations, and these are the same five elements that OSHA recommends for workplace violence recommendations. There's a common theme here. As I said, we already know what needs to be done. Overall, I believe that the violence prevention program should be part of a comprehensive safety and health program in any healthcare workplace. Again, an environment that's safe for workers is also going to be safe for patients. As I said, there are many corollaries with patient safety efforts, including reporting mechanisms to make things better for the patients in that environment. And we also know that prevention programs and training really work. Mr. Woods alluded to that, but we also have, one of your questions was about, Representative Barnhart was about infected, being around bad diseases. And we have a lot of controls and a lot of training prevention programs with that, and we know that's decreased those incidents, so we can apply that same model to workplace violence prevention. So that concludes my briefing, and if there's any questions, I'm here to answer them for you, okay. If I can.
Any questions?
This may be premature, so mm-hmm. if it is, just tell me that. But so far we've heard basically about two models for approaching this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure whether where we want to go is following one model, the other model, or both models
mm-hmm.
in some sense. Well, one model is the criminal model, where we deal with intentional behavior mm-hmm. using the kind of mechanisms that we think of within the context of punishing and rehabilitation of criminals and prevention using a criminal approach. The other is basically the workplace risk approach, which much of what you have to say and also what OSHA has to say seems to be about. I don't want to prejudge the issue, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how those two models interact in this context and where the legislature ought to be thinking about going in the use of those two models as we look at our role, if any, in dealing with this issue.
I'm not sure.
And I asked the model question because you
right.
have that PhD after your name.
Right.
You know, this is the sort of thing PhDs so think about and talk about.
And I do think about those kinds of approaches. So,
Dr. Campbell, I mean, mm-hmm. I guess before you answer that, I want to kind of tag in there with a sub question too with that. Is,
okay.
I mean, really, what we're after here is the focus of really workplace safety.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're after.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. Exactly. And that's the focus of my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I think we have focused on safety in some respects for healthcare workers, but the two largest occurrences of injuries for healthcare workers are patient movement and lift and violent incidents. So I think it's time to put that same focus on those kinds of healthcare worker risk situations. And to me, it seems more comprehensive to put it in terms of safety and prevention. Now, I realize that the reporting mechanisms are part of how we gather all that data and how we assess whether or not what we're doing is working. Whether the criminal piece, I really don't know enough about to be able to speak to if that's the right way to go or not. I really am more focused on the educational pieces and the prevention and the training pieces because I know they work, and I know that we can reduce the number of healthcare worker incidents, violent incidents, and as well as, I mean, lift incidents as well, if we focus on it, if we focus on preventing them. So that would be my approach.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ask your question?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And my apologies if perhaps you did answer this or maybe Michael Wood answered. We've been actually between talking about nurses and then healthcare workers and back and forth. Do we know from some of the numbers and statistics that are the majority of problems that occur with the RNs or LPNs or folks with the nurse vocational background, or is it broader other healthcare workers overall?
I think it's more of a nursing issue overall because there's more nurse healthcare workers than any other class of healthcare worker. And nurses work in all kinds of healthcare facilities, but I also believe it's nurses' aides, it's LPNs, it's orderlies, and it's personal care givers who do nursing types of work or support the work of nursing. So it's in the overall scheme of thing, it's the nursing activities that are, and nurses are do most of the nursing activities. So it fits as a nursing issue, but I believe it's all healthcare workers who
who work in these kind of environments. It's not just a nursing issue, if that was your question.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the task force, for the record, Brian DeLisher, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. You've heard a lot of very valuable information on the data or lack of data, the level of the situation, our members, the nurses that contact me, they believe almost a crisis in which the assaults actually increase rather than going down over the years. Part of that, obviously, is due to, as you've heard, in the emergency room, the interaction with meth, with drugs, those kinds of incidents that are going up. But our members really truly believe that this is a very important issue, as Dr. Campbell has indicated, not only for their safety, but for retention of nurses in the workplace. And so that's why they've asked us last session to bring the issue forward and continue to pursue this issue during the interim and hopefully going into next session. Before I start my formal presentation, let me try and respond to a couple of questions while I was in the room and I was hearing questions. Holly Robinson was wonderful in going through the iteration of 572 from the perspective of legislative council and what the proponents of the bill were attempting to do. As you heard, there was 18, I think she said 19, and I believe there were 19 sets of amendments. Those amendments dramatically changed the bill from its original design. Even prior to the drafting of that bill, however, in its first iteration, there were drafts out that, as you heard, Representative Olson and Senator Metzger went through, marked out, changed, we changed. So there probably was in excess of 20-plus different iterations of this. Many of the issues that have been raised or the questions you brought up were issues that we worked through, including the issue of threats of violence versus the actual violence itself. As you heard, one of the changes that was actually made is to make the assault definition in 572B parallel the criminal assault piece. So we're not talking about threats, we're actually talking about the assault itself. And that did narrow the focus substantially. The question was raised about settings, types of patients and so forth, there's been a lot of discussion about mental health settings versus hospital settings versus home health settings. Just to give you an idea of what it was in our mind as we went through the iterations of 572, first and foremost, it was data collection and correction of the problem. I mean, those two elements. And the question that you asked, Representative Barnhart, was the two different models, the model, the criminal model versus the more education model. We felt that both were essential. First and foremost, an assault, a criminal assault is a criminal assault and should be dealt with in the setting of a criminal assault, in the criminal setting. But, however, we didn't want to ignore those situations that may not rise to the level of criminal assault but may, in fact, be violence in the workplace. So we attempted in crafting 572 with the help of the good representative and the senator to have a kind of a melding of both those models so that really when you have a criminal assault and it rises to that level, that in fact does go through the criminal system. But at the same time, for capturing data, let me just pause for a minute and give you an example. You're still capturing data when the patient may not be aware cognitively of the actions that they're doing, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's a DD client, or whatever, you still want to be able to capture that data in this other model so that you know is there some corrective action, some security action, some different staffing action that can occur that can resolve some of those problems and bring those incidents down. So our response to your question, Representative Barnhart, is really 572 was an attempt to mesh both of those types of models so that you capture as much data as possible and there's some ability to make some corrective action. With that, you should have a sheet that's a one-page sheet, and I attempted to keep our paper down to a minimal. That said, I also gave you four studies that were pretty substantial, and hopefully you'll have some time to go through those. Your staff, I want to thank your staff and Representative Olson for doing a bang-up job of giving you some studies ahead of time, and hopefully you've had a chance to look at them. If you haven't, I'm going to touch on a couple of them very briefly. But there's a very uniform, as Dr. Campbell said, very uniform message here is the problem is real. It's higher in nursing and nursing-type personnel than it is in the other elements of the workforce. And there are solutions that can occur. Going through our sheet, the work, the ONA, nurse workplace violence issues, this is, as Martin Taylor and Susan King and I sat down, we kind of went through and said, okay, what is the outline of what we were attempting to accomplish in 572, and what are the things that are still there that are important to us, both Tier 1 and Tier 2, and what are some things that we can bring to the task force that maybe we feel are still unresolved, and I'll get to those in just a minute. As I mentioned, data collection, very, very important to us, and we think there's two paths. Criminal assault needs to go through the criminal path. We believe internal collection of data that doesn't rise to the level of criminal assault, whether it's in a regular healthcare facility or a mental health facility, is very important, and that's a part of what we think the ultimate solution needs to be. Rights to report to the police. There is right or wrong, and some of the studies mention this too, we believe there in fact is an attitude that discourages reporting. And the information saw that 80% of the assaults or the violent acts go unreported. We want to change that around. We want to turn it around so that policies, internal policies, and the mindset of the nurses themselves are that it's the right thing to do to report this and that there are many repercussions from doing so. And so we would encourage policies, the training, internal training of the facilities that encourages the reporting, and that reporting is, in fact, taken seriously. There are some actions or corrective actions taken, and there's not repercussions back on the nurse for doing so. Patient confidentiality was one of the issues that we really struggled with in 572, because, again, when you're trying to make that determination whether or not the patient is aware of what they're doing, their health history, their mental health history may come into play. And so does it elevate into a criminal assault, or is it something that needs to be dealt with just on the data collection and a corrective action? And so I think 572, when it was finally on the B version, walked a very fine line between the issue of the ability for that data to be captured, those that are making the analysis, whether it's in the criminal side or internally, are making a determination about whether or not there's the ability to understand the action that they were doing, but at the same time capturing the data, which was the important thing, and not elevating those that are not aware of their actions to the criminal side, bringing them over, if you're following what I'm saying. So it did walk a very fine line. There were at least, I think, 6 or 7 sets of amendments just dealing with that particular area, and we can focus on that at a later time or as if you have any questions. The fourth one was hospital policies that safeguard nurses. You've heard about Washington, California, pretty uniform theme. There needs to be training. There needs to be policies in place. There needs to be some annual training of both the employees and the employers. Security is an issue. How do you get a hold of security? Those things, I think, are relatively easy to determine and put in place. And I think when you hear from the hospital representatives, what you'll hear is, in many cases, those types of programs are already in place. Are they to the level of that we would encourage? In many cases, likely. Is it universal in all facilities that we're interested in? Does everybody have this good policy, this good training? Probably not, and that was one of the major elements of 572 is just put the standard in place of what it is we're looking for. The fifth issue, second staff to visit violent patients. The issue, the original bill, in early iterations of the bill, basically gave the right of a nurse that if they had been assaulted or they believe there's a threat of assault by a patient, they had the ability to refuse assignment and basically say, find somebody else to go into Joe Smith's room because he smacked me last time I was in there, or he said he was going to, you know, punch me in the face if I go in there. We moved off that position and basically said, given the inability for the hospital to make those kinds of shifts in patients and assignments that quickly, that there needs to be some way to deal with that, whether it's a second person going into the room to assist, whether it's a security person, it's another nursing personnel. There needs to be some way in which that healthcare worker, that nurse, has some assurances that there's help there and that they're not isolated in a private or semi-private room with somebody who has threatened violence or, in fact, has acted out. The sixth point is home health. There was a lot of discussion during last session about home health in, out. Is the problem as severe in home health? The studies that I provided to you, and hopefully you can just look at summaries in that, but there's pretty universal that facilities are a major problem, but home health in many settings is a problem for a couple of reasons. One is it's a less controlled environment. When you go in at home health, you don't know a lot about the family situation. You don't know about alcohol or drug use from the spouse. You don't know what other activities, whether it's criminal activities, are going on in those facilities. So we would strongly encourage that home health be part of the discussions and what types of home health situations be a part of those discussions as we go forward. At the very least, we believe there needs to be some ability for nurses and other home health care workers that go out to have some kind of a communication system. So whether it's a panic button, a cell phone, some ability to make it known to their employer and to the world that there, in fact, is a problem. They're encountering a situation that may lead to violence or has led to violence. Second-tier issues, not to say that they're any less important, but the first six are really the components of 5782. And if you go down in tier two, it's more of kind of some subsets, some specialty issues. Self-defense, what's the appropriate level? And you heard a little bit about self-defense before, but if, in fact, an assault is occurring or is has occurred, what level of self-defense does the employee have to protect themselves? Who makes that determination? Do they get themselves in a situation where, in fact, they are, instead of the victim, they are facing charges? And so that's one thing that we tried to work through in 572. I think we got it there. And, in fact, actually, there was a House bill last session, and I saw Mary Botkin come into the room, that dealt with the state hospital, and it was a bill specifically to level of self-defense, and it passed unanimously at the House floor. I think we could probably look at that and import it over here if this language is not the right place to jump off. The next issue is perhaps a new issue, and it was actually raised by the Hospital Association to ONA, and we're raising it. They may raise it too. But they believe that one of the issues with increased violence is what they call dumping of violent offenders at hospitals. The issue there is as $1,145 have gone down, the ability for local governments, local jurisdictions, to treat people with alcohol, drug, or other behaviors has gone away, and the local jurisdictions don't have the resources to, in fact, pay for that type of health or mental health care. And so in some cases, the hospitals reported to us what they're seeing is that these types of needs are being placed at their doorstep without supervision, and they're, quote-unquote, no longer in custody because if they're still in custody, they are, in fact, still the responsibility of the jurisdiction. And so we would encourage, as we go through the discussions with this task force and the providers, that that piece be placed on the table as something that needs to be looked at least acknowledged and understood as one of the problems that they're facing and we're facing. State hospitals, the special needs for legislation. 572 did, in fact, include the state hospital for the reason that was mentioned earlier, in which it's data collection. Whether or not this is criminal behavior by patients or not, we believe was irrelevant in that particular setting and in some other psychiatric settings. They were included because we wanted to be able to collect the data and know that, in fact, they were doing everything policy-wise to correct violent situations that were arising. I was encouraged by the E-Board last week, gave the state hospital some additional staffing positions. We would encourage more of that. We do understand that their facility is poor and their staffing levels are insufficient, and that does lead to some of the problems that they have faced. But at the same time, we believe data collection is important to know the level of the problem that they have as far as violence. So, and the last two, I think, are probably the two in my mind that stick out as kind of still on the table, still floating around. We've talked a little bit about it. The other healthcare settings that need to be included, there were a number that were in and out of 572, ambulatory surgery centers, home health, different types of home health run by a county versus home health, private agency, and so forth. I think that's one that maybe this task force will be very helpful flushing out. We believe there are a number of settings, in almost any setting that these workers go into, there's some level of exposure to violence and assaults. Is it as bad in this setting versus this setting? Maybe, maybe not. But I think that needs to be explored. What is the definition of facilities that we really want to come forward with to solve this particular problem? And the last one, which rose during the session on 572, unbeknownst to us in the drafting of 572, the definition of personnel that are covered by this was very narrowly crafted. Although it was broader than just an RN or LPN, a nursing staff, it included aides, the assistants to those, quote-unquote, traditional, Dr. Campbell has talked about, nursing care. There were other caregivers that came forward and said, well, this is fine and well for protecting the nurses, but I'm a lab tech or I'm a whatever, and I don't fit under this definition. And I think that discussion may be one additional discussion that the task force needs to go through. Once you determine what the settings are, then what are the worker or type of workers that, in fact, may be exposed on the numbers show higher levels of assault. With that, that completes this sheet. I do want to point out, and you've heard from Dr. Campbell and Mr. Wood, some of the base information I provided, but actually legislative staff provided you a study, it's a very brief study from the American Association of Critical Care Nurses. Basically, the same information that you've heard, that they're three times more likely to experience workplace violence, that the information in many cases goes unreported for a variety of reasons, both the culture of the nurses and the culture of the facilities. Again, I encourage you to go through. This is a very lengthy study that was supplied to you online from legislative staff, from Mr. Bakovian. But again, the themes are very, very universal, that there's a problem. It doesn't go reported. We have a problem with data collection. Additional study from legislative staff, U.S. Department of Labor, again, pretty similar information. It talks about settings. It talks about incidents and so forth. You've heard all that information. So I would hope you would go through that. And then the one additional of the four pieces of additional studies that were provided, specifically pointed out this AJN study. It's a very brief, it's about three or four pages, but even as you start, it talks about violence toward healthcare workers. It's a significant occupational hazard. You've heard that. This is a very good, very brief study. So if you don't read anything else, this is the one that we would hope you'd read, the one from AJN. It's a three-page, and it was supplied to you today. It gets very good information and summarizes, I think, the multi-page reports. So with that, I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you've been talking and outlining these tiers that you have on your one-page paper, I'm thinking to myself, why should the rights that we're talking about to report to the police be any different for any employee, any place? I mean, shouldn't an employee who's a victim of violence be allowed to report that to the police without worrying that they're going to be disciplined at work for doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I couldn't agree with you more. Just to let you know, obviously, I represent the Oregon Nurses Association, and 572 was crafted just to deal with nurses, and that was a component of that bill that we're very interested in continuing. But your point is well made. I mean, there should not be situations in any working environment in which an employee is discouraged or sanctioned for making a report of what they believe to be a criminal act.
Just to add to that also, I did have a conversation with the Bureau of Labor and Industries or Criminal Rights Division about possibly coming in the future if there's discussion about employers overall creating an environment where they're quashing those types of activities. And so that's been one idea that's potentially been thrown off for maybe a future meeting.
Okay, thank you. And it does occur to me, if I may just comment on this, that there are several of these that, while the incidence of violence or problems may be lesser in other occupations, it's hard to imagine why the same kind of considerations don't apply in other places. You may not want to spend as much effort on training in places where it almost never occurs, but why the other considerations wouldn't apply in other settings is difficult for me to understand, at least. Now, I recognize that you're representing nurses, so that's I'm asking a broader question than that. But.
Representative Olson, Representative Barnhart, again, I couldn't agree more with you. Obviously, one of my jobs is to make sure that my client base is taken care of, and that's my interest. But I think we do need to look at the larger public policy issues in other settings, other situations. This task force is charged with RN workplace violence. Whether this is an issue for another task force at another time, I would suggest that may be the appropriate thing. But I couldn't disagree with you anymore.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Grant, even though there's limited data, I'm wondering if there's any kind of prioritized list in regards to settings where violence is more prevalent than others.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I suspect that out of these studies, there probably is some data. Have I been able to extract from that a prioritization list of based upon different facilities? This is the highest incident. This is the next highest incident, so forth. No, not in that format. I would go back to our staff at LNA and see if there is some documentation of that, some way to take that out, extract that out of the studies that we've seen. But what you've already heard are a couple of settings that seem to be the highest incidents. Emergency rooms in facilities seems to be the highest because it is, as Mr. Wood has indicated, that place where there's the most likelihood of other environmental elements being introduced, whether it's alcohol, drugs, firearms, other weapons. It's the point of initial contact, so there may not be as much time to make that evaluation as to the threat. You've got maybe a life and death situation occurring. You've got to be dealing with that. You're not focused on what else is going around you. With that said, home health, the studies that we've seen seems to be an area of concern. And let me, and this is, of course, anecdotal, but from our members, the places that I hear most often concern is hospital facilities, ERs, the top, but I also hear concern about home health because of the isolation. And so if I were to prioritize, I'd say those are the two, but in answer to your question, I don't think there's any, with the lack of data that we've got, which is one of the problems, I don't think there is any, you know, here's the worst, here's the best, here's the cutoff line, we don't have to worry about any setting below this line. Everything above this line is places we need to focus.
That's, Mr. Chair, that's a concern that we don't make a big enough fly swatter that we kill everybody when we don't need to kill everybody.
With that, Mr. Chair,
that's a big fly swatter.
I really apologize for the use of that.
If I may respond to that question, it is not the intent or the will of the nurses of the state to have something that's onerous on the employers and the work settings. It's been our position all along that if there is not a problem, there are no reported assaults on the criminal side, or there are no violent activities going on in their settings, they have little or nothing to do as far as reporting other than to have a plan in place that deals with and has some annual training. So the fly swatter may in fact be very small for those that in fact don't have a problem. It's those that have a problem that in fact the fly swatter is larger, but probably appropriately so.
Okay. A couple questions, Brian, for you. House Bill 2800. It's my understanding that it currently is going through rulemaking right now. How do you see the increase in nurse staffing impacting the violence?
Representative Olson, interesting question. I think it's one component. I mean, obviously, as staffing and the interaction between the hospital facilities and the nursing staff, they work through their staffing plans. And hopefully, as we turn out more nurses, we get more nurses into the workplace, and we retain more nurses, and we have the ability to do better staffing, it will have some impact on the issue we're talking about today. Because being spread too thin, being stressed as an employee, maybe not spending as much time doing nursing care, and you have to step back for a minute and think of the mindset of a nurse. The nurse not only treats, but the nurse is an educator. And it's educator with the patient and with the family. And if they have time to educate the patient as to this is why we're doing this particular procedure, or this is why we want you to change your diet, or this is why we want you to do certain things, it's as Mr. Wood had talked about, you really de-escalate the violence, the anger, and those kinds of things. So I think staffing and staffing patterns may, in fact, have some positive impact on this. I'm encouraged by that.
Okay. The referring to your memorandum here, and let's see, actually, doctors, would be addressed to you as well. When Michael Ward was up here talking, sharing from Oregon OSHA, he is also sharing his knowledge of what had occurred with the Washington OSHA and the bill that went into effect in 1999. There were three components that he identified. Prevention plan for the hospitals, training, and also record keeping. Those seemed to be the three main, the theme that he had from Washington. We have six here that are reflected. How do you see just those three Washington, if we were to take those and just work them here in comparison to these?
Representative Olson, as I understand what happened in Washington, I would have to take a look at the statute, but depending on Mr. Wood's portrayal, that bill did not go as far as ours. Both in the criminal side, as Representative Barnhart had talked about, it talked about dealing with internal situations rather than the criminal assault piece, which is of an interest to us. But the other point I think you need to focus on, what Mr. Wood said in portrayal of what happened in Washington, is that information collection is happening internally and is not in a central repository, someplace in which we can, as a society, as a state, as legislators, as providers, become aware of where are the problems. It's an internal process. And that's one of the other things we were trying to get to in 572, is put data collection in some central place where it can be manipulated, filtered, as the question about that you had about, would the level of assaults or number of assaults go up? Well, no, we're really talking about a new subcategory. And in working with the state police and the data collection, what they indicated to Representative Olson and myself was that they would just have to have a new identifier in their computer system that said, okay, now we want to be able to pull out assaults on nurses. They already do that in assaults on public safety officers. That is a requirement by federal law that they have the ability to do that, so they would just have to have a new identifier. So, quite frankly, I'm delighted that Washington and California did something. I don't always take my lead from what other states do, but it's helpful information, and I think Washington probably didn't go as far as I think this bill was to solve the problem on both the criminal assault side and the data collection.
I would have, Representative Olson, and I would have said that this bill has more specificity than the Washington bill does. So.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you for your time. As we progress through our the work plan, we intentionally today, at the direction of the chair and the staff, did not bring a number of nurses who have been put in these situations. As we go through, we would like to have the opportunity to have some of the nurses who have in fact been assaulted tell their story, so that you can see the not only the type of situation they're in, but also the emotional, the scarring that's going on and the impact it has on nursing.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, I would really appreciate it if you could maybe be involved with our planning process.
Representative Olson, I would be happy to do that.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, Representative Tomei, it's good to have you here today.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Welcome here.
Thank you.
Okay, is anybody interested in taking a quick little recess? No? Okay. Well, obviously, Representative Berard wanted to.
I quick housekeeping.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Occasionally hear a buzzing coming from above. That's not DAT, that's the LCD projector buzzing. Supposedly there's a certain type of cell phone there, whenever there's an incoming call, even if you have it on silence or vibrate, it'll create that sound. So if you hear it buzzing again and you're getting an incoming call, please turn your cell phone off completely. It's just certain types of phones, so we know where it is out there. Thank you.
All right. I actually probably have some suspects out there. Not to mention anybody's names. But. Okay. Mary Shepherd and Dr. Deborah Burton. Are you? Okay. Excuse me.
Here
we go. Dave. Okay. Bodyguard? Is that what it says?
Morning, Mr. Chair. I'm turning my cell phone off, if that's okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, task force members. It's nice to be here for your chair's maiden voyage. I'll try to call him chair and not captain. for the record, my name is Dave Fiskum. I'm here representing Providence Health System. With me today are two additional representatives of Providence, whom I'll introduce to you in a moment. First, just want to remind you that Providence is Oregon's largest and most diverse health system. We operate hospitals in urban and rural Oregon, in Portland, Milwaukee, Hood River, Seaside, and Medford. We also operate a number of special programs, one of which is Providence Child Center near the freeway in Portland at 47th and Halsey, more or less, located adjacent to Providence Portland Medical Center. Another of which is a home health operating unit. And then we also operate, as you may not know, nursing homes around the state, including Providence Elder Place in several locations in the Portland area, Providence Benedictine in Mount Angel, and a number of nursing home beds in Seaside associated with our hospital there. And we do as well have a major health insurance carrier, Providence Health Plans, which covers the lives of thousands of Oregonians as well as a number of Oregon Health Plan recipients. It's with that background that prompts us to be here today, primarily to underline our commitment to two major objectives: quality patient care in our facilities and the safety of all staff, including nurses, in those facilities. We have no higher objective, no higher commitment than that. Let me add that we came here today not necessarily with the background per se of the Senate Bill 572, though I, on behalf of Providence, was heavily involved in all of its deliberations last session, but we took your work plan on its face and started from a more general perspective of an educational, informational kind of approach. And so to answer a question asked earlier of your chair appropriately and not of me, we didn't start with Senate Bill 572. We didn't start with Senate Bill 572A engrossed, and we didn't start with Senate Bill 572B engrossed, though some of those things you've heard about those bills are points that I might even agree with or disagree with along the way. Our intent was to follow the guidance of this year's first meeting and to be more general in our approach. I think you'll see that in a few moments as we go through our remarks, as well as if we are able to try to answer your questions. With that, then, let me do something I do best, which is to introduce experts from our system who know more about patient care and safety than I will ever know. First, to my immediate right, is Dr. Deborah Burton, who serves as the Regional Director for Nursing Education and Performance for Providence Health System, and she has a long and varied career in the nursing profession. As a quick aside, her curriculum vitae, which I have read, runs, she will be embarrassed to have me say, to 11 pages. But she is a person of some substantial credentials. To her right is Mary Shepherd. Here is a resource if you have questions after Ms. Burton's comments. Mary is Risk Management Director for Providence Portland Medical Center. So, Mr. Chair, thank you again, and with your leave, I will turn the microphone over to Dr. Burton.
Thank you. Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for having us here. I want to add also that Mary Shepherd is a registered nurse, as am I, and as well, Providence Health System does operate hospitals both in California and Washington.
Dr. Burton, this is just a technology. You're doing well. If you'd identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I am Deborah Burton. I am a nurse. I am responsible for all of the education and performance of nurses in the state of Oregon in the Providence Health System, about 5,400 registered nurses in total. Thank you for having us here today. This is an issue of grave seriousness to us. I am presenting to you officially today on behalf of Kathy Johnson, who is the nurse executive for the state of Oregon for Providence Health System. She could not be with us. I'd like to start by addressing the question, why is risk for violence higher in hospitals now than, say, it would have been 20 or so years? There are a number of factors at play over which we have little control, but they do affect the extent to which we experience risk for violence in hospitals and health systems. One is the Institute of Medicine report. If you haven't had an opportunity to read that, that was the document that really sort of scared the public about safety in hospitals in general and brought to the forefront some issues that we really needed to face quite some time ago. Everything from errors that were made routinely to safety issues. So the sensitization to the issue was suddenly in the public eye. We were being held accountable. But more recently, and I think probably most profound, is the fact that we no longer are allowed to just restrain whomever we think should be restrained so that they won't hurt us. Obviously, a lot of wisdom in the legislation, but it does affect us adversely in dealing with people who we know have the potential for violence. I have a long history in clinical practice. I've worked as an IV nurse, and you tell a child you're going to put an IV in their arm, and they've had it before, and they say, okay, I'm ready, I'm not scared, you've poked their skin. They punch you in the eye, and the next time you say to yourself, next time I'll restrain them. We can't do that anymore. Is the child violent? No. It's just a reaction to being hurt. I've been kicked by women in the late stages of labor. Just a reaction to being touched because they're in such agony. Are they mentally ill? No. Are they violent? No. Is it intentional? No. But I've also worked in other places where I've known better and have put myself in situations I should not have, even with the training. I have gotten on the elevator with someone my gut told me wasn't safe. I should have not done that. I had the training I needed. I didn't think. Now, 15 years ago, that would not happen. So the sensitization that then was compounded by just the general sensitization to violence in the workplace in general, that really, I think, was the whole notion of going postal, happened in the mid-90s. And it made us even more vigilant about paying attention to anything not just violence, but risk for violence in our environment. And then last, as you've heard over and over, we who operate emergency rooms really are operating large social service agencies, corrections agencies, mental health agencies, drug agencies, because there is nowhere else for this highly violent population to be brought. They are brought to us. So with that, I want to remind you that Providence Health System operates the two out of all of the hospitals in the state of Oregon. We only have two presently designated magnet facilities for the employment of nurses. We are held accountable for our standards in safety, in prevention of risk, and so forth. There are only less than 5% of those hospitals in the United States. We are, however, also deeply committed, clear up to our values and the reason why I exist, protecting our patients, both the dignity and respect of our patients. So I do think it's important also to spend a little bit of time on definition. There is nothing black and white about violent things that occur in health service delivery beyond criminal assault. Criminal assault is black and white, should not occur, should be prevented, and should have the proper follow-up. I'm not going to speak to that. I think lawyers and corrections folks do that better than I. But beyond that, there are many events that happen that to the victim look like they're intentional. They may or may not be. Those are the things we need to be preventing. But more importantly, I think we also need to be very clear about what constitutes violence. Because if we just took layers 1 through 4 presented by my colleague from OSHA earlier, you'll notice none of that talks to sort of escalating behaviors in a patient or a family member that would tell us this person will become violent. So just focusing on violent alone doesn't allow us to prevent it. And that is because when you're trained to deal with violence, de-escalate it, manage it, know how not to put yourself in a potentially violent situation, your cues are to the person's history, but more their behavior, and it may be sexual assault, it may be sexual harassment, it may be verbal abuse. All of that is in the cycle of violence, and all of that is what our staff need to be trained and protected. So counting violent acts, however defined, are only part of it, training our staff to know when they're in an unsafe situation, how not to get there, and how to de-escalate, manage, and who to call, are all of the pieces that we pay attention to as we vigilantly also report incidents and collect the data that we need to. So having said that, I would remind you that with some anesthetic agents and some drugs or having a child, all of us can become violent. The most docile patients in the world have a reaction to drug and become violent, and it is our job as employers to assure that nurses and all clinicians have the training that they need so that they are not put in the position of when the kid says, yeah, put the IV in, hits the nurse is not in harm's way, knows that can happen, knows what to do, despite the fact we no longer can restrain most patients against their will. Our 150-year mission of care and providing treatment to everyone really is part of the reason we're here today to talk about making sure that we don't use the giant fly swatter, using your analogy, to make sure that those patients who, for whatever reason, do something that to the victim feels and looks like violence. This is much like pornography. We all know it when we see it. But when you're in the victim, it's a different thing, and we want to make sure that definitionally and risk management-wise, we do the right thing, and we know how to do that. And it does start, as my colleagues earlier have said, with a plan in place, with proper training, with sensitization. It could happen to anyone. And I think also to make sure that we don't just pay attention where there is a lot of violence, because unfortunately, wherever there's a bad thing that could happen, say, for example, where we administer chemotherapy, some of the most harsh chemicals in the world are administered to cancer patients. They can kill you. They're lethal if you don't handle it properly. But the oncology nurses know how to do that. It is in the places that may not experience this often that we also need to pay attention to make sure that nurses who don't encounter potentially violent patients very often also have the training, because they are not used to it in the environment on a daily basis. A couple last things I'd like to sort of just reiterate for you. The kind of constantly managing the environment is really, I think, a consequence of the Institute of Medicine study. We're pleased about that. It has really caused us to rethink what is a natural consequence of working in a hospital and lifting injuries and violence and some of the other incidents that have happened in the past just are not tolerable anymore. And for that, we're held accountable as the employer. We take that very, very seriously. I do want to also say that we have been in contact with our counterparts in both Oregon and Washington in terms of their experience, and how we're reporting is not too far from how they are reporting. We have given to you a draft of a form that we are in the process of using. We can't do a whole lot policy-wise without good data. We will continue our work in training. In my job, we always say education does not change practice, and it doesn't. My sitting and lecturing you about what to do if you're in county environment won't really change your behavior. But what does change behavior is actually getting people to do this. And our training includes putting on shorts and bare feet and getting on wrestling mats and taking down someone who's potentially violent. And that is the thing that does allow our staff to try it as individuals and as well feel confident and empowered that they are safe in a potentially violent event. We do have security officers posted around the clock who also have very, very specific training. But it is important to remember that all of these protective devices and tactics and strategies in education will not make violence go completely away. Just as we have to train to make sure nurses know how to handle hazardous substances, we can't take the chemotherapy out of the hospital. It's part of the work we have to do. Providence very much appreciates and shares your concern for our safety and our well-being of not just nurses, but all providers that care for patients. And we want very much to be a partner in the discussions as we move forward. This is very important to us. And we would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Just a very quick question. Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Burton. You use the phrase nursing magnet hospital. What is that?
A magnet is a designation that is earned through an arm of the American Nurses Association that, given a large volume of criteria, a hospital is known for outstanding patient care, what we call a destination employer, that they do the things that it takes to retain nurses, to satisfy nurses, and to treat nurses professionally. It is given to about between 3 and 5% of all hospitals in the United States. There are two in Washington and two in Oregon, and two of them are ours. Every 3 years, then, the hospital has to be recertified. You don't just get it and then go soft. You have to. The bar is set higher and higher as you go, and so Providence... St. Vincent has had it two times now in Providence. Portland, where Mary works, just received it last year.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Burton, we've heard testimony that violence against healthcare workers is escalating. Why?
I don't know if that's true or not. I can't speak to that. I can say how it's reported and how it's tolerated is also changing. So to me, it's much like in the old days, we didn't talk a lot about sexual harassment. When we began to talk about it, it began to look as if there are more. For the reasons I mentioned earlier, we can't restrain people. There's more emergency room. There's no mental health place to take a meth addict, and they come to us. The sort of intense nature of a hospital itself, when we have shortened the length of stay. Earlier, my colleague spoke to the nurse as educating and supporting the patient. Well, the fact is, you don't have a week to have a baby now. You have hours. And so the intensity of what goes on, the pain of what goes on, the time in which we really have to help people get used to, you have a terminal illness. Your mother is going to die. All the awful things that we need to deal with constructively, unfortunately, we don't have the time. And it is a very intense environment. That doesn't just mean it's more violent. It means the intensity of the work of the nurse and anyone who's in this very intimate relationship with the patient needs to pay attention to all the things that come with dealing with deep emotional issues without a lot of time to do it.
Thank you.
I'm curious, the draft that you referred to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still in draft form right now?
Yes. What I've learned is you can't just make a form. The lawyers and the process takes time. We're a very large system. But the nice thing is we have a great deal of experience with our friends to the north. Providence Health System has a number of hospitals in the state of Washington who are already complying, and their experience is well within a parallel that we're working through, and that's why you see it as draft.
What do you see as a date for implementation on this? Do you have kind of a projected date that you're wanting to get this implemented?
Charleston, the intent is to do it now without the form. In other words, we already have processes for reporting unusual occurrences and injuries. If any violent act results in an injury, it's already expected. This just raises the bar higher to make sure that anything gets reported that must. You know, in the past, we kind of relied on the individual. Now it's the supervisor is held accountable to make sure that it gets reported.
This question might be better addressed to you, Mary, but we'll find out here. Who would be able to access this information then once you start compiling the data or what you already have?
Again, I'm Mary Shepherd from Providence. Portland Medical Center. I'm the risk manager at Providence, and I am a nurse. All that form that you just showed would be available to all of our employees. And the expectation would be that after they're involved with any kind of an incident, that they would complete the information that is requested on that form. They would report to their supervisor, and then, as is indicated, they would certainly seek the appropriate medical care if that was required.
Have you had cases where an incident has been so severe where law enforcement has been called to respond? And what have you done then with their reports, or have you been able to access their reports, law enforcement?
I do believe that we have had incidents in the past where law enforcement was involved. And I don't have firsthand knowledge of our availability of the reports of the law enforcement folks, but I do believe that we have access to those.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, could I just make three concluding brief comments, because I know you're perhaps not pressed for time under your leadership on this year's maiden voyage. First of all, I hope the comments that we've made today have illustrated to you that we do care deeply about this issue. One of the suggestions made about hospitals in the last session that irritated me then was that we as institutions tolerate a culture of violence in our facilities, which is not true, even though, as Dr. Burton has said, there is violence. Unfortunately, we try to prevent it, and we respond to it. Secondly, of my own knowledge, I am unaware of situations where hospital administration attempts to quell or quash the ability of individuals to, forgive this phrase, call the cops when necessary. And that comment was made about a concern in that area, and to revert to something I said I wouldn't do, Senate Bill 572 has some provisions in it related to a perception that somebody is stopping somebody from calling the police when necessary. I'm unaware personally of that to the extent that somebody may think it exists. And then lastly, and most importantly, on a very positive note, Mr. Chair, I've appreciated your openness at all points along the way in this process. And as Dr. Burton has said, Providence, and I think I could speak for other hospitals whose representatives are sitting behind me, we're prepared to work with you very closely throughout the four or five meetings you have, including, I think, invitations have been extended to you to visit our hospitals and talk directly and personally to nurses, which you'll be able to know is better than just talking to lobbyists. So please take advantage of those offers we've extended to you around the state, and I think we've tried to make those offers available to you close to where you live or work. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll let Dr. Fickle talk to you for a while.
Mr. Chair, before we let these folks go, will Mary be speaking? Will you be making a presentation?
No.
Okay, then I do have some questions sort of waiting. So help me understand, the both of you were saying that there have been incidents of violence, and there is some way of reporting that, but with the new form, that will be more formalized. So do you have those statistics? I mean, what I'm not hearing from you is there were so many incidents of violence reported last year or in the last 5 years, and this is how it was dealt with, and these were reported to law enforcement, et cetera. So do you have those figures? Do you have that information?
Mr. Chair, FM Tomei, we'd be happy to provide you with some numbers that reflect our OSHA reports. We didn't come prepared today to provide those numbers to you, though we could do that to your staff for transmission to you. I think the reason, as I would put it to you, from my vantage point on behalf of Providence, is that for us, this issue isn't a numbers issue. This is an issue we take every instance of violence, as we've described what that term may or may not mean, seriously. We, whatever the prod or the cause of that situation, we work to prevent it if we can, and when we can't, we work to respond to it. Bottom line is we don't have numbers today. We'd be pleased to provide those to you. They are reflective of our OSHA reports.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, of course, I'm new to this whole issue, and I know it was probably vetted during the last session. Is that
yes.
just when you had
That's
hearings? Right. So all of this is new to me, so I would appreciate getting those figures. That would be great. Or maybe you already have them from the previous committee.
No, I don't. Mr. Chair, one, it's possible to suggest without knowing who's behind me for sure that the best source is OSHA itself. And then Dr. Burton wanted to respond to that.
Well, if I may respond to that, thank you. I understand that by law you must report those kinds of situations to OSHA. I guess I'm interested in ones that would not necessarily have gone to OSHA.
Representative Olson, Representative Tomei, I do want to make a point clear that to me this feels a lot like when we first decided it wasn't okay anymore for nurses to get back injuries from lifting patients. It took some time to get nurses sensitized. If the patient falls on the floor, you don't run over and pick them up. You use proper procedures. You get help. It is not your job. This is not a natural consequence of practicing nurses. We don't do this anymore. It took some time. My example earlier of the child hitting me when I stuck him with the needle, would it ever have occurred to me that I should have reported that? No, because, of course, my compassion was for the child. I had a bruise. Oh, well. Now, we have to make sure that nurses feel supported, and this is all healthcare workers as well, reporting, being specific, and getting to zero tolerance. And with falling and lifting, we're really close. But it is really important that we understand what we call sort of the epidemiology of violence, or in my work, risk. Where is the true risk? Not just how many incidents do we have, but what do we not know? We have patients who wake up from surgery swinging. You could call that violence, or you could call it waking up from surgery, but the fact is people get hurt, and those we need to clearly identify the problem before we begin to rely exclusively on the numbers that are reported either to us or to OSHA. It's important, but there's more to the picture.
Thank you.
Question. And this might click back to House Bill 2800 again, and I don't know enough about the rulemaking process where it's at. The hospitals will be expected to collect potentially more data about what's happening on different shifts to determine if perhaps there are situations occurring in certain parts of the hospital, certain shifts where nurses are more apt to be hurt. Is that too vague?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berkobian, I will confess ignorance, which is something I do also very well, which is I'm not sure where exactly we are in the process of House Bill 2800 rulemaking. We'd be happy to get an answer for you. Turning around, I don't think we have the best answer to your appropriate question unless somebody else behind me does. We'd be happy to respond. Point made.
Yes.
Yeah.
Representative.
Like Representative Tomei, I'm new to this issue. And I'm having a real tough time today trying. I know where violence ends, obviously, in a death. But I'm having a real problem trying to identify a patient grabbing the arm of a nurse versus scratching versus punching. I don't know where this begins, and I'm having a real hard problem in seeing where we draw the lines here.
Representative Olson, Representative Girard, I couldn't have illustrated better myself. As I said, these are not black and white. Sometimes your arm gets hurt and you're so busy you don't even pay attention to the fact that till you go home and drive, man, I have a bruise on my arm. I didn't even think. I didn't even know. Is it violent? Probably. There isn't an answer to your question. I wish I could. But there certainly are lots of factors in the workplace that we can get nurses to focus on that will say it is very likely that when you do X to patients, the reflex will be Y, or many patients have this reaction to this anesthesia, or if you have a violent spouse coming into the emergency room, these are things you need to make sure are in place to protect you and others around you. So there isn't an answer to the question, where does it start, because I don't think anyone knows. But making sure we know where it is in our environment, just as where lifting injuries happen, is half of the battle. And most of us are not completely 100% trained in mental health, so it's important that we have at least enough mental health background to be able to screen and know where there is risk for violence.
So really we're focused much more on, rather than responding, but on prevention. Am I correct there?
Yes, sir. I believe that we should focus first on risk and preventing. But the fact of the matter is the nurses also must feel, and all employees must feel safe. And that means they know that when they do report, that there is a procedure in place for responding. And that is true for any kind of injury, whether it's a needle stick or a fall or a patient falls. It's both. And I can't say we should do one or the other, but I can say we have a lot more to learn about risk in our industry in general and what we need to do to support the employees that work there.
Thank you.
Okay, any follow-up, additional?
Yeah. That last is very really useful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Fickle. And if you, you know.
I need to set up my
okay.
computer.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Patrick. Patrick. Patrick, can we stand to use a second?
I would have done it earlier.
Here we're going to pick small recess.
Yeah, let's just move right along.
Okay. Dr. Fickle, if you'd go ahead and introduce yourself.
Good morning, Chairman Olson, members of the committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to discuss these issues with you. For the record, my name is Marvin Fickle. I'm the superintendent and chief medical officer of Oregon State Hospital, located in Salem and Portland. Prior to this position, I was the chief psychiatrist for the Department of Corrections for about 5 years. I was asked to discuss the issue of violence against nursing staff at the hospital, hopefully in the context of understanding why such incidents occur, and to describe the hospital's efforts to decrease their incidents. I will be presenting our actual data to clarify these issues, but we'll begin with a description of the hospital and the type of patients that we serve so as to make the information hopefully comprehensible. As you have heard this morning, there is obviously a broad consensus among all involved that the issue of nurse violence and against hospital staff in general is something that's unacceptable. You may have heard my comments and those of others of the Hospital Association during the last session describing our difficulties with the particulars of 572, but the reality is that we all are very concerned and are doing as much as we can at this point to try to minimize the incidence of such injuries and assaults. Oregon State Hospital was founded in 1883 and has been the primary long-term mental hospital for Oregon since that time. At the present, the hospital serves about 700 patients in our Salem campus and our Portland campus together. Two-thirds of them are forensic patients, and I'll explain in a moment what that means. About 120 are civilly committed adults, and another approximately 100 are in what we call our neuropsychiatric geropsych program. It's also important to recognize that about 10% of our gero patients and about a quarter of our civilly committed adults also come from either the Department of Corrections or previously were in our forensic program. As you can appreciate, the overwhelming majority of our patients are in what we call the forensic psychiatric program, with about 100 patients admitted directly from county jails for what is called competency restoration, also referred to locally as a 370 or aid and assist patient. The 370 refers to ORS 161370, the statute which provides for the treatment of persons found unfit to proceed by the court. The remaining 350 patients are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, or the PSRB, having been found guilty except for insanity, Oregon's version of guilty by reason of insanity. Or not guilty by reason of insanity, excuse me. In prior testimony, you have heard about the levels of injuries that occur. I'm moving a little too slowly here. You have heard about the levels of injuries that occur in various settings. Before I present the data for our hospital, I would like to describe the nature of the patients that are admitted to our forensic program, the place where most of our assault and serious injuries occur. As I have mentioned, about 100 patients have come directly from county jail, usually untreated and displaying behaviors that have prompted their attorney or the court to request an evaluation of their competency to stand trial. If they are found not competent, they are sent to the hospital within 7 days. These patients are a mixture of seriously mentally ill individuals who are currently psychotic and an increasing number of seriously drug and alcohol impacted persons who frequently do not have a demonstrable mental illness. The latter group is often young, previously involved in a variety of criminal activities, and with a history of aggression towards both others in the community and in jail. The PSRB patients are similar in distribution, with young, often in their 20s, sociopathic individuals presenting the greatest risk of injury to the staff and to other patients. Here I am using the word sociopath in its narrowest sense, specifically an individual who commits criminal acts, lacks empathy, and considers such acts both reasonable and appropriate. There continues...
Thank you. I'm trying to understand your classification system. How would that last bullet group get into your facility in the first place? Are they malingering mental illness, or is it something else?
Chairman Olson, Representative Barnhart, hopefully we'll briefly touch on that issue somewhat later in the morning.
Okay.
However, what you're describing is, from the standpoint of the state hospital, one of the great deficits of our current system. It involves a difficulty that extends through multiple layers of our criminal justice, law enforcement, and mental health community services. The inadequacy, as one might put it, in the ability for people to receive drug and alcohol treatment, for instance, which was referred to earlier this morning, is a major component of that. The fact that our county jails are woefully inadequate to deal with the number of people for whom they are required to take in means that there are people who for whom they don't have any other way to deal with it. And the courts are similarly impacted by the same group of people, also with very limited resources to deal with them.
Okay, then a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. So would this include people with acute toxicity from the ingestion of substances, or would that be one of the categories, or people with a longer-term dementia resulting from overuse of drugs?
Representative Chairman Olson and Representative Barnhart, it very clearly would. One of the difficulties that you can appreciate happens with a county sheriff in trying to manage his county jail is that so many young people these days who are arrested are involved in serious drug and alcohol abuse or involve individuals somewhat older with long-term effects of such use. It is very difficult in the confines of a county jail to adequately treat someone or even deal with the you know, increased levels of violence which occur as a result of that acute toxicity or early dementia.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Some of you have heard testimony during the last legislative session concerning our employees' desire to send such individuals as Representative Barnhart was referring to, quote, back to corrections where they belong, despite our efforts to educate our staff about double jeopardy. A brief mention of explanation there. Obviously, if you are found guilty except for insanity, you are no longer held to the standards which would allow you to be retried on that or sent to Department of Correction jurisdiction. I will readily acknowledge that working with incarcerated, non-mentally ill persons in a hospital setting is a challenging endeavor, one which is made more difficult by the lack of appropriate consequences for the injurious behaviors that do happen. As you may appreciate, the ability of some individuals to, quote, get away with it after having assaulted staff or peers is not lost on other patients. The unit milieu rapidly deteriorates under such conditions, and appropriate behavior becomes less the norm. Let me clarify that what I am talking about is not the occasional outburst from grossly psychotic individuals who might strike out during the course of treatment activities. Our staff readily understands and accepts the risk of injury during such encounters with seriously mentally ill persons. Rather, it is the planned, calculated attacks on staff and peers by a small number of non-mentally ill individuals that is the source of most serious injuries and nearly all of our serious assaults. The availability of help from the state police is limited, with their understaffing levels equal to our own. The district attorney's office is likewise reluctant to intervene in all but the most severe injuries for reasons that are legally and fiscally sound, but leave hospital employees with the sense that their status in the eyes of the law is unimportant.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question? Is it going to be okay if we interrupt to ask a question?
Certainly.
You'll mind it,
okay.
Dr. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Fickell. Dr. Fickell, it sounded like in your professional judgment, these are people who are not mentally ill, who were inappropriately placed in the state hospital. Am I correct in assuming that?
Chairman Olson, Representative Tomei, I intend to expand on that in just a few moments, but I think the issue is one which has sort of been the 800-pound gorilla that's been in the room for quite a number of years, which, frankly, we really were unwilling to address directly during the last legislative session because of the systemic difficulties which, frankly, are involved in that are behind that problem. I do believe, from the standpoint of a hospital administrator, that to effectively deal with this issue will, in the long run, require us to address the reasons why such people got into the hospital in the first place.
And follow up, and why they're kept in the hospital.
Chairman Olson, Representative Tomei, as I will expand on just in a moment, the hospital is not the one who makes decisions for this two-thirds of our patients about whether they get in the hospital or get out. Those decisions are made by the Psychiatric Security Review Board, who have a slightly different statutory requirements than the hospital does.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Complicating this situation is the fact that many patients have both a mental illness and criminal behavior. It is often impossible for even the best clinician to determine whether any given behavior stems specifically from either a mental disorder or criminality. For some academics, this distinction is irrelevant, as its determination is so complex as to be unknowable. However, in real-world hospital treatment, and in law enforcement, the difference in approach is essential, as changing behavior is the desired outcome, and mistaking willful attack for impulsive outburst leads to increased frequency of negative behaviors rather than their reduction. You might ask, how has this situation arisen, and is this different than it used to be? You have heard from a number of speakers this morning addressing the fact that there does appear, and we'll review again just in a moment, the national statistics on this issue that would seem to indicate that this situation has worsened over the last several decades. Why that happens, or why it has happened, is one that I'm going to touch on what I think are some of the major issues, and you've heard some of the issues already. However, I think what you have heard and what has driven SB 572 initially was the emotions that are tied up with this sense of our inability to address some of the questions that have been asked just now by Representative Tomei. Again, the answer to these questions about why the situation has arisen is not as simple as it might be, and that there are political and judicial decisions and changing hospital accreditation standards that have impacted the hospital over the past decade. These include Measure 11, which, with a shifting of criminal defense strategies to avoid long DOC incarceration, and the Panner decision, which required the hospital to rapidly admit anyone found unable to aid and assist. The changing role of hospitals, especially on the East Coast, has given rise to an expectation in accreditation bodies that the individuals that I have described above are not the concern of a state hospital. In fact, in most East Coast states, most such individuals end up in correctional settings where assaultive behaviors are dealt with in a prompt, individualized, and effective manner. States such as Massachusetts have ended the problem with their state hospitals by essentially abolishing state hospitals. This has, in turn, resulted in a myriad of problems in local alternative settings, as you've heard in part in, even in Oregon here, shifting some of our current problems in our Oregon hospitals to other settings in Massachusetts. In response to the initiatives of the federal government through the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as the Joint Commission, the hospital has actively implemented strategies to reduce the use of seclusion and restraint and to promote patient autonomy, choice, and recovery. One of the untoward and poorly recognized side effects of these changes, which I would readily acknowledge are very positive ones, has been the emergence of criminal activity in the hospital setting, nearly always by patients who lack a significant mental illness. This is not the setting to discuss how such persons found their way into the hospital rather than being sent to prison, but it reflects a variety of problems in both mental health and law enforcement arenas, largely the result of inadequate resources to investigate and provide treatment. The presence of individuals who lack a mental illness in the midst of a hospital milieu of people with significant mental illness is both dangerous and unproductive.
Could I stop again? Thank you. What did you mean, freedom versus patronizing staff?
Chairman Olson, Representative Tomei, one of the shifts which has occurred, many would say finally, in mental health treatment, generally throughout this country, internationally in fact, has been the shift away from the traditional medical model, which you might encapsulate as rather having a rather patronizing view of what a patient, quote, needs to do, to a model which in essence turns that on its head, which for many of our patients means recognizing what it is that they feel is appropriate and what they need to be able to return to the community and to a productive and worthwhile life. These would include many of the kind of things that we all take for granted, being able to determine where we live, how we live, with whom we associate, being able to have a regular job or an educational opportunity, to involve oneself in relationships which bring hope and meaning to one's life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
These individuals which I was referring to, namely those with minimal or lack of substantial mental illness, are often predators, using the less fortunate, functional individuals for their financial gain and mocking the staff for their attempts to intervene. I have personally witnessed too many incidents with such persons telling me, go ahead and call the police. They're not going to do anything. As a sidebar, I should note that usually these comments are somewhat more vulgar than that. Such is the frustration of our hospital staff. These are people who came to work generally wanting to help individuals with mental illness, only to be confronted with a small number of nasty criminals who make their job nearly impossible. The other factor which has contributed to the difficulties of the state hospital in this arena has been the well-documented overcrowding and understaffing that the state is aggressively attempting to correct. It is well established that crowding a lot of people together brings out the worst in everyone. When you have 40 to 45 individuals housed in a unit budgeted for 35 and really designed for 30, it should come as no surprise that the frequency of aggressive incidents goes up over and above the influence of the sociopaths and impulsive individuals that may complicate the situation. We have worked hard at the hospital to bring down the census, and the significant efforts of both the community and the hospital have borne fruit. We are still about 20 patients over our budget capacity, but this is considerably below the overcrowding of a year ago. Understaffing continues to be a problem, contributing both to the lengthening of time that patients are in the hospital due to their inability to receive intensive treatment that they need, and to the low staff-patient ratios that lead to mandated overtime and exhausted employees. Undoubtedly, better training of staff would result in fewer injuries. As you may be aware, to be a cadet policeman or DOC officer, one must complete a mandatory basic police training program at DPSST, which is soon to be 16 weeks duration, followed by, depending on the jurisdiction, at least a month of classroom and mentoring programs. In the state police, it's 3 to 6 months minimum. The current basic training program for persons going to work at the state hospital consists of a 10-week coursework for a certified nursing assistant, unfortunately, which has an emphasis on nursing home care, but essentially no mental health contact, and 8.5 days of hospital-specific training. The CNA training course at Lynn Benton Community College, for example, requests, quote, a high school diploma or GED is recommended along with selected immunizations. It is also preferred that students be 16 years of age or older. You should be able to read English at the 7th grade level. As you can appreciate, a hospital is expecting a staff who is marginally trained to work with the most seriously disturbed individuals in the state under conditions that are much less than optimal.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Proceed.
Thank you. Dr. Fickle, so who develops those staff training guidelines?
Chair Olson, Representative Tomei, I presume you mean for the CNA, which are the... we would call the mental health technician series employees at the hospital, which are in essence supervised by the registered nurses.
Right.
The CNA coursework is determined by the State Board of Nurses, as best I can determine, with individual community colleges to determine the specific classroom work that's described. There have been attempts, beginning at least in the early 90s that I'm aware of in this state, to legislate specific training programs for individuals to work in such facilities like the state hospital, community placements of a variety of sorts, with specific mental health training along the lines of those programs in California, which result in what's called a psychiatric technician. However, as far as I've been able to determine, most of those programs have not gone very far, in part because there's no separate licensing category for such individuals. And correspondingly, there's no financial incentives for people to get that additional kind of training.
Follow-up?
Proceed.
So, to your knowledge, is this training similar to what would be required in other psychiatric hospitals in the state?
Chair Olson, Representative Tomei, part of the issue that we have at the State Hospital is a reflection of the kinds of problems that are also experienced by many other psychiatric hospitals, namely a great difficulty in hiring registered nurses. You've heard reference to the fact that this is a national emergency, essentially, that the nursing shortage has resulted in very many hospitals relying on what, well, if you're a nurse, really great recruitment efforts, We unfortunately cannot compete effectively with many of the private sector hospitals with signing bonuses, with hourly salaries which are upwards of $10 more an hour than we can provide, or frankly, which is probably the most important aspect in terms of recruitment, namely working conditions. The individuals then who have largely supplanted registered nurses of the state hospital fall into this other category of what we call the mental health technician or mental health therapy series, which involves several different levels of trained individuals. Among this group, there's a large number whose training consists of exactly what I just described.
Follow up. I'm still somewhat confused. So in other psychiatric hospitals in Oregon, would there be the same certified nursing assistants who have the same requirement for education?
Chairman Olson, Representative Tomei, I would have to rely on the statements of other facilities of which I'm not currently acquainted, although I would say that the efforts of most psychiatric acute care facilities would be to staff those units with as many registered nurses as were possible and to utilize these lower or less well-trained individuals much more sparsely.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just for clarification, I'm not sure if this affects psychiatric hospitals. I know with nursing facilities, for example, there are certain federal requirements for certified nursing assistants, I believe, and then the state can either meet the federal minimum or have increased or additional requirements. Does that apply also for psychiatric hospitals? Are there federal regulations that dictate a floor of training, and then the state can have additional?
Chairman Olson, Mr. Bacobian, I am not really facile with that part of the law. I believe the Oregon Board of Nurses could probably refer you to those our local statutory requirements. As part of the job descriptions for those individuals, the CNA is a required certification. And again, the certification requirements are determined by the Board of Nursing.
Thank you.
All of that said, one might argue that the number of injuries at the state hospital is remarkably low given the seriously undermanned conditions. You've heard reference this morning already to the U.S. Department of Labor Occupational Safety and Health Administration guidelines for preventing workplace violence for health care and social service workers. I'm sorry, that's their title, not mine. And I'm just going to, again, in case you didn't recognize the essentially orders of magnitude difference in terms of the violence that nursing employees experience relative to other workers in the community, I'm just going to put those figures up again. So that, for instance, and they use two different measurements, and I wish that I was able to show our own data in that form, but I'm not currently able to do that. But the assaults result in injuries, and you'll see that these two categories don't exactly match, and they have a long methodological description in that piece about why there's these differences. What's important, I think, is to recognize the disparity between the 2 per 10,000 and the nursing and personal care of over 10 times that number of injuries, which they're saying nationally occur. And the Department of Justice, in their crime statistics, reflecting a all occupation rate of 12.6 per 100,000, mental health professionals of 68.2 and mental health custodial workers of 69. The nursing figures, which is first given there, is all nursing. The second, the 68.2 number, is reflective of nurses in a mental health context. Again, you can see the literally five times the number of people who are injured relative to other types of employment.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Proceed.
Thank you. So when it lists mental health professionals, is that just nurses or is it all mental health professionals, including the psychiatric aides?
Chairman Olson, Representative Tomei, it's my understanding, it's been a while since I actually read that publication, that the mental health professionals they refer to is the whole gamut of individuals, nurses, what we would call the mental health technicians or psychiatric technicians in other settings, orderlies, et cetera, right, in a mental health context or a mental health hospital.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The follow-on in that publication, which again is made reference to, but I really do think requires to be underlined, is a quote that says, as significant as these numbers are, the actual number of incidents is probably much higher. Incidents of violence are likely to be underreported, perhaps due in part to the persistent perception within the healthcare industry that assaults are part of the job. Underreporting may reflect a lack of institutional reporting policies, employee beliefs that reporting will not benefit them, or employee fears that employers may deem assaults the results of employee negligence or poor job performance. It should be clear from these numbers that healthcare workers and mental health workers in particular are injured in much greater numbers than nearly all non-construction jobs. And what I heard from Mr. Wood from OSHA this morning, it appears that they've now supplanted construction jobs as the worst industry. So how do the hospital rates of injury compare to these figures? I regret to report that at the present time, the hospital lacks the capacity to determine similar rate structures. I can report the number of injuries relative to the census, which I'm going to present in a series of charts. And I have the assurance of Mr. Wood that he will assist the hospital in providing the technical assistance to be able to do that. It is not, as he assured me, a simple task. The question that is almost always raised and has been raised repeatedly during the hearings last spring and summer regarding the issue of injuries and over census is one which we have taken a look at. This graph represents the number of injuries in the entire hospital reflective of the upper line, which is the ADP or the actual census days in the hospital. It is not well represented in this chart or the following one, which represents the forensic staff injuries. But the correlation is actually quite good. And you'll have to excuse my lack of facility with statistics, but the Pearson product moment correlation coefficient is nearly 0.5 for the situations, for the statisticians in the crowd. This would apparently explain about half the variance in the injury rates at any given time. One of the consequences then, as you can see from our graph, in bringing the census down has been a reduction in fairly significant numbers of staff injuries. I should say that these are reflective of an environment which I believe nearly every one of these staff injuries is being reported, certainly during this time frame. We have made an active effort along with a public relations effort by SEIU to make sure that we adequately track these particular kinds of injuries. And as I'll talk about in a little while, the ability to track attempted injuries or very minor incidents is also undergoing some changes. So what have we done to try to reduce staff injuries over the last several years? Beginning in early 2005, we began to use an updated staff training program, which is called PROACT, a nationally recognized interventional skill set whose focus is on early intervention in the cycle of aggression, refining verbal skills for de-escalation, and utilizing appropriate physical intervention only when necessary. This program is a revision of the training we have used for the past 5 years, and we have both expanded the number of hours new employees are in training as well as retraining nearly 100% of our current employees over the past year. As part of this, we have attempted to engage line staff into the active training program so as to assess the satisfaction of those to who use these skills daily. We have also initiated individual patient programs for a number of individuals who have caused frequent injuries to staff and other patients. In a number of cases, these were based upon security issues rather than mental health issues. This procedure is generating significant animosity in the advocacy community. There are those who apparently are willing to trade increased staff injuries for, quote, patient freedoms. There is a widespread belief that such individuals can be managed in the same fashion as in prison. This is not the case. The readily available consequences of a prison setting, including specialized disciplinary units, are not used in Oregon hospital settings, despite essentially identical behaviors and causal factors. Advocates argue that the real problem for the hospital is the overcrowding and understaffing issues. If only enough staff were thrown at the patient, including multiple professionals, this problem would be greatly reduced. This level of intervention has been shown to be effective in a variety of patient populations, including groups with lower cognitive function. However, the levels of staffing utilized at facilities such as Atascadero State Hospital in California, where they have implemented such programs on a regular basis, are usually 40 to 60% higher than current OSH staffing levels, and even higher in the clinical professional ranks. We are attempting to implement such programs by increasing the number of professionals while simultaneously reducing unit populations. This increase in staff-patient ratios should allow the implementation of specialized programs for some of our patients. There remains a number, however, for whom specific therapies are indicated. We will continue to struggle to obtain these, although the availability of trained professionals with these skills is very limited, even in Portland. As mentioned earlier, crowded hospital units contribute to increased aggression. In addition, the very dated design of much of Oregon State Hospital, the extended linear wards first promoted in the 1840s, has long ago been abandoned in favor of radial designs, which allow for direct observation of the entire unit from a single viewpoint. If the OSH master plan moves forward after the April e-board, I would expect that any design work for a new hospital would utilize such modern designs, which allow for safer, less staff-intensive observational capabilities. With unit size from 18 to 24 patients, depending on the function of the unit, these problems can be more easily ameliorated with a smaller number of patients housed on a single unit. As you might imagine, one consequence of staff injuries is a worsening of recruitment and retention for nearly all employee groups. The media coverage, which has generated an interest in improving the hospital and the mental health system in general, has also alerted potential employees about the working conditions at the hospital. Annual turnover rate for entry-level mental health therapy technicians is over 25%. While this is better than the 50 to 100% turnover of equivalent positions in community-based residential facilities, it is unacceptably high both as a training investment strategy and a workforce development standard. If we are to attain, if we are able to achieve reasonable levels of employee longevity, skill acquisition, and career advancement, we must address the workplace conditions. Couple of these difficulties. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Quickly, on average, I guess, if such, for example, with a nurse, how do they compare to the private sector? I know nurses sometimes receive bonuses amongst commercial hospitals for signing on, and are salary and benefits appealing in your hospital for, and I guess, same for mental health workers? They will work for a private psychiatric hospital. How's that? Do you know how it compares?
Chairman Olson, Mr. Bacobian, thank you for allowing me to talk about a subject which is really, obviously, very clear and dear to my heart. Having a sister who is a nurse and has recently been looking for a job specifically in mental health arena, I am able to tell you that at the present time, the entry-level salary for mental health or psychiatric nurses is anywhere from $6 to $10 more per hour in the Salem area for registered nurses. That does not, however, include many other perks which you alluded to, which make changing jobs a very easy task in the nursing field, and which, frankly, contributes to our problem. Namely, a nurse coming right out of training can easily get a job at the state hospital, and with 2 or 3 years of experience under their belt, are able to move on and make considerably more money elsewhere. In terms of the community residential facilities, which I alluded to earlier, many of those employees are minimum wage employees or just scarcely above that, which greatly contributes to the inability of our community facilities to adequately employ enough people who are trained well enough who are going to stick around. You can get someone perhaps coming right out of school who's willing to work for that kind of money, but frankly, they're not going to stick around. That said, I want to thank both the legislature and the Department of Administrative Services for taking great efforts during the last year and a half to have substantial increases, both in terms of our line registered nurses as well as our management nurses, to allow us to at least approach the ability to hire people from the private sector. As you can appreciate from those comments, it's easy to understand why Oregon State Hospital has a nursing vacancy rate jumping around anywhere from 16% to 20% any given month. Although I believe that the hospital would do well to rely much more heavily on registered nurses to provide basic services, that is going to be very difficult if we can't hire nurses. We cannot determine who comes to the hospital, when they arrive, or when they leave. These issues are controlled by the courts, law enforcement, state and community agencies, and the availability of appropriate housing in the community. The hospital has struggled to manage a patient population that has been impacted by the violence of the street, confounded by the inroads of methamphetamine, and left homeless by deteriorating personal resources. People come to the hospital with less reserve, fewer skills, and declining future options. It is this universe that our patients inhabit, one in which using violence to obtain one's desires appears both reasonable and without equal. Our task is to convince them otherwise, and if not, to reduce their aggression and minimize injury. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share these thoughts with you.
Questions? Getting back to Dr. Pickle, the attempts to reduce assaults that you mentioned about the PROACT program, or how often is that presented?
The Chairman Olson, members of the committee, the PROACT program is one which is a trademarked proprietary program, which we send individuals to, or we have individuals from that company come on site, train our local trainers, who then train our current employees. The full 2.5-day program is presented every 2 weeks to our new employees, or thereabouts, and on the intermittent week, or the interleaving weeks, are presented to the for an update to our current employees. We have attempted over the past year to essentially retrain and bring up to date all of our current employees to the newest standards of PROACT.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And perhaps this is something for a future meeting to a different group, too, that maybe to be asked is perhaps what's available or what are hospitals doing in terms of accreditation requirements, internal policies, to provide maybe additional training, how often they should do that internally with their own staff, specifically around preventing violence and that kind of thing. So I'm just kind of throw that out there to the task force. They might want to look at that more broadly.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. We saw Providence's draft of how they report incidents of violence. Do you have a similar form that you use to report violence?
Chair Olson, Representative Tomei, in an effort to, in essence, get ahead of this process, I was finally able to implement a computerized online incident reporting program last fall in October. Prior to that time, our incident reporting system was a purely manual, paper-driven one, which was ineffective both as utilizing as an executive management tool as well as really gaining some sense of real-time data. With our current system, we are able to essentially, within 12 hours, track any kinds of incidents from those which range from the 801 reports, which are the OSHA reports, or the safe claims, rather, to incidents which involve very minimal interactions of a that potentially could have escalated or involve patient-staff contact in some kind of way.
Follow-up. So have you found that that's been helpful to minimize the violence or control it at least?
Chair Olson, Representative Tomei, as you heard earlier in terms of looking at the responses to the Washington bill or the Washington statute, it's unclear at any given moment what it is that is likely to be a variable that we can intervene on, which is going to make a real change in what happens. We believe that one of the most important factors, that is of the overcrowding, is being addressed, although certainly not to the level which I would like to see it. And that has already had a substantial impact on our injury levels. The other major factor that we talked about, I mentioned, having to do with staffing levels, is we're also attempting to address. We've added, with the assistance of myself and other members of the legislature, 41 additional positions at our MHT level, which has now made it possible for us to, in our maximum security units, to have essentially a full complement of employees on a regular basis, so there's not the great turnover of people being shifted in from other units. The third factor, which we really have not yet digested, has been for the first time in 3 years there's been a decline of admissions under the Psychiatric Security Review Board. In 2004, we had 124 new insanity defenses that were successfully negotiated and persons were placed under the PSRB. In 2005, we only had 84. It looked like back in July and August of last year that we were heading to hit at least 124 and maybe even more. Something happened in the middle of last year or at some point during that year that has had an impact on the number of people who are either putting forward the insanity defense or successfully negotiating that. We don't at this point know why that is.
Successfully negotiating it?
Well,
referring to
almost, well, essentially all insanity defense in this state is stipulated by both the defense attorney and the DA, so that at the point it's never taken to trial. They're always stipulated decisions which the judge is then required to sign off on.
If I can follow up, I'm somewhat confused by that. So it doesn't go to trial. So you're saying, though, you have fewer people admitted under the PSRB. So what happened so that there are few people coming under that aegis?
Chair Olson, Representative Tomei, that is the it's probably a $12 to $15 million question. We've, in essence, only in the last couple of months became, well, since the end of December, been aware that these numbers really were going to turn out as low as they have. There's a number of things which might have been impacted. One may be the education of our judges, or further education of our judges and DAs and defense attorneys about PSRB. The fact that for many potential insanity defendant people who might plea submit that they were mentally ill at the time and incompetent are not taking that route and going to DOC, where they in fact have shorter sentences at this point.
I see. Okay.
And the final issue, though, is that it's unfortunately been the number of 370s, the number of competency restoration cases, have greatly increased.
Competency restoration.
That's the aid and assist in the patients who are sent to the hospital to regain their ability to aid and assist their attorney to be able to stand trial.
That has decreased?
That's increased and continues to do even as we speak. Again, we don't know why.
Okay.
Give me an idea of what percentage we're talking about for increase on that. I'm curious.
Chairman Olson, I'm sorry.
Last 10 years.
That kind of numbers I don't have in front of me, and unfortunately I would be able to. I'm looking to try to get that information, but it's not currently in one place.
Don't pursue it. Sorry.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Dr. Vickel, I sat here and listened to you, and was my jaw dropped open a couple of times. Especially when you talked about the fact the highest risk factor are from those that are not mentally ill. And I said to myself, well, wait a minute, this is a state hospital for the mentally ill. And then you've explained that you have no control over this gate that opens and lets people in and doesn't let people out. It's a gate that works only one way, which is not a good gate. Is this a problem with the judicial system in allowing pleas and bargains of this nature? With this, could you speak to that?
Chair Olson, Representative Gerard. I will undoubtedly say some things today which will...
I don't want you to get you in trouble.
Well, I'm probably already in trouble. That's.
Do you mind, Mr. Gerard, if we kind of pass this part here, we'll get this in judiciary probably.
Sure. Well, Chairman Olson, I would like to share with you actually some anecdotal conversations that I have had with members of the judiciary all the way up. And I think that they would tell you to a woman or man that from the standpoint of the judge, they don't have a lot of power over what happens in these cases, because those decisions by virtue of Measure 11 were in essence the realm of the prosecuting attorney or the district attorney. If, as I have also spoken to the district attorneys about this issue, they will respond fairly similarly, which is, with the incredibly declining real resources that we have, we are struggling to try to deal with this group of people in the same kind of way, that the numbers are in fact much larger than we ever see at the state hospital. If you talk to county sheriffs, as I have, they will tell you the same thing. It is not only a behavioral problem in the county jails, but an enormous fiscal drain on the county jail budgets, just in terms of the psychiatric medications that they're using. This is not a blame game. And I certainly am not one to suggest that there's any particular group, because I don't believe there is, who's responsible for having this situation deteriorate in this kind of way. The reality is, and if my comments seemed a bit grim, it is that the systemic issues which we're trying to deal with at the state hospital are really reflective of a lot of problems in many areas of how we do business, in the law enforcement arena, in judiciary, etc. As I've had many conversations, of course, with detectives from the Oregon State Police, a similar kind of problem where... And then that was what led to our decline to be real supportive of 572. We looked at the numbers of incidents that we have at the state hospital currently. For the Oregon State Police to effectively do what 572 wanted to happen would have required two full-time equivalent OSP detectives to be stationed at the state hospital. That's the level of incidents which occur. And I don't think that's a... for me as a state bureaucrat, if you will, to take that forward to the legislature, I believe would be seen as disrespectful at the very best.
This is very quick. In my former life as a county commissioner, the mentally ill in our jails are one of the most enormous problems that counties are just unable to deal with. It's been that way for a long time, and there's no one looking at trying to correct it. It's kind of off the violence against nurses thing that we're into, but it is part of that whole picture, and I thank you for bringing that part to our attention.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, well, Dr. Pickett, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. His task force is closed for today. Okay.